STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Welcome to the show, friends. Glad to have you on board on Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel, that's my name, your host here for the next 3 hours of clear-thinking Christianity. That's the way I like to characterize it. And I'll be sharing my thoughts with you, and you will be with me as you call in here on our show, and I'll interact with you. I give you a piece of my mind, you give me a piece of yours. That's the deal. I'm defending, of course, classical Christianity and classical Christian values. I think Christianity is worth thinking about, and I'm going to try to bring my best reflections to the table here to help you think about these things as well, regardless of what side of the fence you happen to be on. Many times what I end up doing is looking at a cultural issue or maybe something that's happening in the news, and I am not as concerned about the details as much as I am concerned about the ideas, because the ideas have consequences, and not just for what's happening in the moment, but also for long term. And there is something in the news today, well, at least news for me, I guess it's been a couple of days out, that I need to talk about with regards to the big picture. Not because I know that much about the details. In fact, since I'm not a basketball fan at all, I know nothing about the principles involved or even the teams. But I will say that for reasons that will soon become obvious, that I need to hold my nose a little bit as I do this commentary, because I'm going to venture into something that is deeply unpleasant. And I don't want anyone to be confused as to the nature of my comments, because I'm going to talk about something that happened that was really despicable. Yet what the public response has been has troubled me, and I'm going to tell you the reasons why, even though I think that what happened was despicable. So this is why I need to hold my nose a little bit while I do this. Apparently, according to this headline here, NBA, National Basketball Association, bans Clippers owner. Clippers would be a basketball team, which I understand is from Los Angeles. So that shows how out of it I am. Tom just gave me a look here through the glass, like, where have you been for the last 20 years kind of thing. But in any event, all right, so his name's Donald Sterling, and he has been banned for life and pushes to force a sale of team. So that's the NBA pushing to force a sale. That phrase is in quotes. Now, what happened? Apparently, LA Clippers owner Donald Sterling has been banned for life from the NBA and given the maximum fine possible for racist remarks. That fine, by the way, announced by NBA Commissioner Adam Silver, is $2.5 million. So what happened? Apparently, and as far as I know, there's little question as to the facts of the matter. But Donald Sterling was captured on tape as making remarks to a female interest in his life, let's just put it that way, regarding black people, African Americans. And the remarks reflected a deep prejudice against them, or it appeared to, reflected a bigotry. And actually, the remarks, I can't even read them to you because there's other foul things in there that bother me as much as the other comments that are racist. So there's no question this guy is not a very pleasant fellow, which is why I say I have to hold my nose when I talk about this. However, Apparently, Sterling was to receive a Lifetime Achievement Award at an event next month to mark the 100th anniversary of the Los Angeles NAACP. Now, of course, the organization has changed their mind on giving him an award in light of the comments that surfaced the last couple of days. According to this news report, he had been given a Lifetime Achievement Award from that organization in 2009. So in one sense, he's been keeping his public nose clean, so to speak. But these private comments really are pretty offensive and understandably for many disgusting. So I'm not going to defend those at all. Personally, I think from what has been reported here that Donald Sterling's remarks were deplorable. They should be roundly censured by anyone and everyone who is decent. I'm a little bit skeptical of the claims of so many who said their feelings were hurt by these comments. It strikes me the only person who's really getting hurt here is Donald Sterling. But all right, I mean, people have different sensibilities about these things, and fair enough. From what I can tell, for the record, the guy, that would be Donald Sterling, is a first-class jerk, and apparently in many more ways than one. Now, having said that, I think that the actions taken against him have been draconian, which means I think they're really severe. Yes, he's been censured publicly. That's when people say publicly that what he did was wrong. That's entirely appropriate. Now, I don't know what his private arrangements are with the NBA and how all of this inside stuff works. But he is not only the guy is not only under a lifetime ban from the NBA, but he's prohibited from attending games or practices or stepping foot inside any Clippers facility. Now, this is the guy who actually owns the Clippers, which are worth close to $600 million. And there are efforts to force him to divest himself of that ownership. Now, I don't know how that works. And I don't know how can you force a man to sell his own property, even if he says something really despicable. And see, this is where I start to get uneasy. I am not in any way, shape, or form defending the ridiculous things that this man said. But lots of people say ridiculous things as far as my values are concerned, and I'm not looking for blood from them because of that. And the concern I have goes back... I'm certain that... let me back up before I say this. The concern I have has to do with actions taken against people who have offensive points of view and express them. All right? That's the broad characterization. And some people might be thinking, well, he doesn't have just offensive points of view. He's a bigot. He's a racist. Okay, well, that might be true too, but that's a point of view. Now, it's different to act those things out. That is to treat people in ways that are inappropriate. That's a different factor here. I'm just talking about his own views. A number of years ago, I wrote an article, and you can find this on the website, str.org, called Why Hate Shouldn't Be a Crime. Now, does this mean I'm in favor of hate crimes? No. Am I in favor of hate? Absolutely not. I just don't think that it should be criminalized. I don't think that hate is a virtue, but rather that people shouldn't be punished for what they think or what they believe, even if what they think or believe is despicable. Now, I have to move slowly through this so I am not misunderstood. certain behaviors are despicable and certain beliefs are despicable and certain ways of expressing one's self are despicable. And it is easy when someone who we disagree with says something offensive for us to step up and then demand our pound of flesh from that person without realizing that it could be our ox getting gored next time around if we put the principle in play. Back to the Why Hate Shouldn't Be a Crime article, if we want to criminalize hate because we see some behavior over here that we don't like, and so we don't like that, and so we want to punish that person for that thing, all well and good, until something about our belief system, and I'm not picking out Christians here in particular, I'm just saying in general, something about our belief system becomes labeled hate at some time in the future, and then the same actions we were approving of in the first case against that other person that we thought was hateful and should be punished in some fashion now are taken against us, and it's our ox being gored. And I do think with regards to Donald Sterling's remarks, I'm pretty convinced that if his statements had been about Jews or Christians, no one would have even noticed. But since they were about a politically charged issue, that is racism, which I think is a weighty issue, I'm not diminishing it, but it is politically charged. I think attacks on Jews and Christians verbally are also weighty issues, but they're not politically charged at the moment. And consequently, they are not preferred concerns, so that these ways of responding are not consistently applied, which gives me pause, because if culture was concerned about virtue across the board, all right, well and good, but it doesn't seem to me that that's the case. From what I understand, this person's personal life was a mess. There are all kinds of disgusting things that apparently he was involved with, but no one censured him on those things because they weren't politically incorrect. In any event, I want you to see the bigger picture here, and I want you to think about this. Have you ever heard the statement, gay is the new black? Now, if you've been in play at all in this conversation, you know that the homosexuality issue has been compared to race, such that if you have objections against homosexual behavior, then you are guilty of the kind of bigotry that drives racism. Now, of course, there is no comparison between the two, and I've made this point a number of times, because when it comes to homosexuality, you have a behavior in question, not a benign skin color. You have behaviors that are chosen, not a color that is not chosen. And the list continues, the dissimilarities when it comes to a moral issue. Nevertheless, they've been grouped together conveniently because it is easy for, let's just broadly say, the left to make their case regarding homosexuality by trying to draw a parallel between the two. Same thing with same-sex marriage. Oh, they said the same thing about interracial marrying. You shouldn't do it. It was unnatural. And, of course, we have responded to that in the past. And simply put, there is no parallel because skin color has nothing to do with marriage and sex has everything to do with marriage. And so if there is no similarity in a morally relevantly similar way, then the point is not carried. But I want you to think about that statement, gay is the new black. And remember, and this is where my concern is, I think the guy's a cad, but I think that the reaction to this man and what is the punishments that have been levied are over the top. And my concern then becomes, though I haven't shed a tear for him, trust me. At the same time, my concern becomes if this kind of reaction and punishment can be levied against him for his bigotry, for his racism, then what happens when someone else, maybe Christians, get in the same crosshairs? And lest you think I'm overreacting, I want you to listen to these quotes that have to do with this particular situation with Donald Sterling. Here, coming from Sacramento Mayor Kevin Johnson, who is a former NBA All-Star, "I hope that every bigot in this country sees what happened to Mr. Sterling and recognizes that if he can fall, so can you." Notice that the objection is not against his racism, it's against his bigotry, of which his racism is an example. But the racism is a subset of the broader concern, which is labeled here by Mayor Johnson as bigotry. Notice also the NAACP in their comment: "The alleged statements made by Mr. Sterling were deplorable and cannot be tolerated," the organization added. "Bigotry and hatred have no place in the NBA or any other arena of society." Other NBA owners have called the remarks attributed to Sterling abhorrent, reprehensible, hurtful, and said they have no place in the league or anywhere in society. Now, I just want you to see something that it may be subtle here, and maybe I'm straining a little bit too much, but I don't think so. When I was younger and things like these happened, people would say those kind of remarks have no place in polite society, in civil society, in civilized society, whatever. It was a censure. These statements are they have no place anywhere in society. So the implication is we're going to do what we can to punish these people so that they don't even hold their views anymore. They're not allowed anymore. Bigots. Notice the complaint is bigotry, at least in two of those quotes. And here's really my point. If bigotry of this kind, and I think his comments were an example of bigotry, but if this can be punished in this way, what prevents the cultural elites from labeling objections to other behavior as bigoted and enforcing a similar kind of punishment? And of course, you know, I'm talking about, for example, homosexuality and the word of choice being used to describe those who oppose anything to do with homosexuality, including same-sex marriage, is bigot. And how about Jesus is the only way of salvation? Do you think that might ever be construed as bigotry? And if the cultural elites are simply not going to put up with bigotry of any kind, as they've announced with regards to this issue, then maybe we're in line too. Now, I'm speaking rhetorically here when I say maybe, because I don't think maybe, I think we are. And we have been in line, and this is already happening in Christian circles, but I just want you to see this trend. I personally do not think that objections regarding homosexuality are grounded in bigotry, not anymore. I think they almost never are nowadays. There might have been a time when there was more of that, but look, though followers of Christ largely have a live-and-let-live attitude on this issue. But that doesn't matter, because simply using the word bigotry has been enough to silence dissent on the homosexuality issue, whether the word applies or not. You think people are asking themselves whether the definition applies? No, not in this. Not when it comes to this politically correct issue. And I frankly don't think people should be punished in the way that Sterling is being punished for having despicable points of view, even when they are despicable, and his points of view on this are despicable. No question. I think a person should still have the freedom to be a complete creep if he wants to. Because once you give the green light to this kind of treatment for those reasons, the same rationale can be used to justify abuse for other offenses that people choose to call bigoted, even when they are not, in fact, examples of bigotry, but are labeled so. And as far as the NBA is concerned, maybe they have contractual legal latitude to be able to do what they're doing. I just don't know the details. I can't tell you. But even so, just because someone has the legal liberty to punish does not mean that it's appropriate to do so, in my view. My biggest concern has nothing to do with Donald Sterling. From the abundance of the mouth, the heart speaks, all right? My bigger concern is a rationale put into place, an idea that's put into play, an idea that has consequences, that when we see bigotry, we can punish it aggressively. And then anything that gets labeled by the elites as bigoted is liable for the same punishment. So fasten your seatbelts. I'm Greg Kochel. Your calls in just a moment.
I'm J. Warner Wallace, and I'd like to commend to you, if I can be so bold, a book I've written that'll help you examine the evidence for the Christian worldview. It's called Cold Case Christianity. My hope here is to give you 10 principles of cold case investigations that'll help you examine the claims of the Gospels. I've also given a 4-part template that'll help you examine the Gospels from the perspective of eyewitness reliability. Can you trust what the Gospel writers told us? Were they written early enough to have been written by true eyewitnesses? Have they been changed over the years? Is there any way to corroborate what's been written in the Gospels? And finally, is there some bias held by the Gospel writers which would preclude them from being trustworthy eyewitnesses? I hope Cold Case Christianity will give you insight from the perspective of a detective. You can purchase Cold Case Christianity by visiting the Stand to Reason store at str.org.
The most practical thing you can understand in order to answer the challenges of skeptics and critics is the Bible. It's God's revelation that we represent to others. You can get a better grasp of God's history of redemption in Greg Kochel's video series, The Bible Fast Forward. The Bible Fast Forward gives a practical, historical overview of the Old Testament, emphasizing the unfolding plan of salvation as God reveals it through his covenants with the nation of Israel and the fulfillment of those covenants in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. You'll gain an understanding of how the central topical elements of the Christian story of reality play out historically from the fall to the cross. I'm convinced you'll gain a clearer understanding of the important themes of the Bible when you study the Bible Fast Forward. You can order this DVD curriculum that includes a comprehensive study guide by visiting STR's store online at str.org. Give us a call at 800-2-REASON or visit str.org to order the Bible Fast Forward.
Show Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. And we keep losing this caller, and he gets back on. We'll see if we can keep him on this time. It's Salem in France. Bonjour. Are you there? Oh, we lost him.
Hi, Greg. Oh, yes, this is Salem.
Oh, great to talk to you again.
You too. Nice to hear you.
Thank you. Let's see. We saw each other last summer.
Yeah, that's correct. After the apologetics seminar in Strasbourg.
Yeah, and we had a great dinner at your home with your wife and your two children, as I recall.
Yes, which we're honored to host you at. Thanks.
Well, it's good to chat with you again. What's on your mind?
Quick question. Sorry if I might be a little slurry or slow. It's quite late or early in the morning, actually.
Yeah, I'm flattered you'd stay up to call. Thank you.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying I'm flattered that you'd stay up to call. I know it's big change in time zones there.
Well, the question I had was, the Bible instructs us as Christians to, like, be hospitable to one another without begrudging, turning the other cheek, etc., you know, such verses. But the question is, how far should that be taken? Is it still acting in a Christian and biblical way if our Christian hospitality is, like, being taken advantage of, and we now feel like we are, like, the offending party has, like, worn out their welcome?
Yeah.
I should give an example. Like, for example, my wife and I, we have some good friends who have a certain individual very regularly and boldly inviting himself to their home for regular meals, you know, expecting him to give him a lift when he needs, you know,
right.
expecting shopping and stuff, kind of like a very poor me sort of attitude. He does have a job, but doesn't like to use his own money, it seems. And so our friends are very accommodating, you know, feel kind of obligated because of their Christian faith to be of service. But it's gotten to the point where their graces are kind of worn out,
sure.
understandably so, you know.
Yeah, well,
but,
you know,
what kind of scriptural backing could we offer them in, like, finding a right balance and not feeling guilty?
Okay, a couple of thoughts here. You mentioned the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus talks about turning the other cheek. In that particular mm-hmm. case, he is specifically making reference to people who give offense and our response of not taking taking an action what's the word I'm looking for, like revenge, because
okay.
he says if somebody slaps you how did he put that on the right cheek
yes.
is that the way he puts it on the right cheek turn
yeah,
to him
and
the left
him
also
together.
Okay, so most people are right-handed. How do you mm-hmm. slap a person on the right cheek if you're right-handed? You're facing somebody. You slap them on the right. The only way you can hit them from the right is if you essentially you backhand them.
Yes.
Okay? So a backhanded slap to the face is an insult.
Mm.
And what Jesus is saying here is that you don't take your own revenge when you are insulted. This is what this particular passage is speaking to, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You don't take your own revenge when you're insulted. You just
okay.
let it slide. Now, the book of Proverbs, I think it's chapter 19. I could be wrong on that, but there's a proverb that's applicable here. It says, a man's discretion makes him slow to anger, and it is his glory to overlook a transgression. So Jesus is counseling us to just let those kinds of slights slide. Let them go. Don't take your own revenge. Don't return evil for evil is a phrase that pops up a number of times in the New Testament. That's what's being spoken of there. So I don't actually think the turn the other cheek verse applies in the circumstance that you have just described. Okay.
It would be more like being hospitable to one another
yes.
without begrudging, which I think is in 1 Peter 4 somewhere.
Yes, but I think that there's limits to that. Because
yes,
keep
course.
In mind, and so I'll give you some alternate verses, and you can suggest these to your friends. I'm just going off of memory, but I think it's in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, it says that if a person does not work, he should not eat. And the one who does not provide for himself is worse than an unbeliever. So the point here is there's certainly a place for hospitality. My sister and brother-in-law came over for dinner last night. They're in town. And so they live in Seattle, but they were down for a wedding. And so we were able to kibitz mm-hmm. and carry on. And we made a meal for them. And then we went out and we got yogurt afterwards, frozen yogurt, you know, and actually I was prepared to purchase that too, and he jumped the gun on me and got to the cash register first, so he paid for it. But in both of our hearts, there was a spirit of being mm-hmm. hospitable to our guests, all right?
Mm-hmm.
However, yeah. and that's what is applauded in the scripture, to be hospitable to your guests. However, there are the lazy ones also that Proverbs has a lot to say, the sluggard who puts his hand in the dish and he won't even bring it back to his mouth, which is kind of a hyperbole or an exaggeration to say they got their hand right in it and they're so lazy they won't even pick their hand up and stick the food in their mouth, you know, you got to spoon feed them. Well, see, this kind of sloth is not a virtue, it's a vice, and it's spoken of directly against in the 2 Thessalonians passage. So there's a principle there. When we have a Christian who is not doing as he ought with regards to provision, then that Christian ought to be held accountable for that. And so if our extension of appropriate hospitality becomes a means by which a Christian who is able-bodied is not fulfilling his or her other obligations as an adult Christian person, well, that's when I think the hospitality has turned from a virtue into a vice, into an enablement.
Mm-hmm, yes.
All right, and I am sure that your friends who feel taken advantage of by this other person are not offering their hospitality anymore with a cheerful heart. It's not a pleasure to them to do that because they think they're being taken advantage of. And when a person oftentimes is confronted about this, then the person will get defensive. Well, I thought you were Christians, you know, and then plays a spirituality card on them. Of course, one could always say in reverse, I thought you were a Christian too. But it's important not to be manipulated by that. Let me give you another passage that I think is helpful, and I actually employ this with my daughters. And it's in Galatians chapter 6. But before I get there, let me tell you how I have two daughters and a 9 and a 6, and we drop them off at school, and we pick them up at gymnastics and stuff. And I am really amazed, and I've noticed this for a long time, how parents are the beast of burden for their children. That is, the parents are carrying the books and the backpacks and the lunch thing and everything. They're all overwhelmed by all this stuff, plodding towards the car, and the kids are skipping along. Personally, I think that's a mistake, okay?
Yeah, and, me too.
And so when my girls, I mean, if anybody carries anything, the girls should carry their own thing. If Papa doesn't carry anything, fine. It's not my stuff. It's theirs. And so when we get out of the car, I have the girls, don't run to the front door. You have to come and take your bag. And then I cite for them the passage out of Galatians chapter 5, that we bear each other's burdens, but each person should carry his own load. All right? Bear each other's burdens and thus fulfill the law of Christ, it says there in Galatians. But then it says that we each must carry our own load. Looking for it right now. So verse 2 of chapter 6, bear one another's burdens, therefore I fulfill the law of Christ. And verse 5, for each one shall bear his own load. And there it goes into talking about the one who is taught the word is to share all good things with the one who teaches him. Now, the application Paul is making to that, with that principle in verse 5, is that if you are being taught by a Christian, then you owe that person. And it is your appropriate load to bear to compensate that teacher or pastor or whatever appropriately. The broader principle here, though, I think is really helpful, that there are burdens that are excessive. And when we are with each other and one has an excessive burden, we come up underneath that burden and help that Christian to shoulder that excessive burden and therefore fulfill the law of Christ, which is the law of love. However, oftentimes it's not an excessive burden. It is the appropriate load that the other person ought to be bearing that they're trying to offload onto us. And that's the point at which we should say, no, this is not our responsibility, even given hospitality. This is your responsibility, and you are falling short of Christ by not bearing your own load. Because look at Salem. If somebody is pushing their load on someone else, that is the load that is theirs to bear, and let's say they're pushing it on Salem. Salem, you've got your own load, right?
Yeah.
And they push their load on you, which is theirs to carry. How much room is there now for you to help somebody else by bearing their burden?
Yes.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So you're carrying all these other people maybe who are shirking their responsibility. You don't have anything left for those who have a genuine need of sharing that burden. And so there is this mixture here. And so I tell the girls, all right, girls, bear each other's burdens, but each one should bear his own load. These backpacks are your load. If you can carry your backpack and your lunch and your books, I see you. There, you're doing fine. Great. I know it's heavy. Well, if it's not a burden, if it's not something excessive, you're going to carry it because that's yours to carry. And I want my daughters to understand the distinction here, that they have to pull their own weight in our family and in the world. And for the most part, I think in our culture, kids are catered to way, way too much.
Yes.
And when we are at dinner at our table, okay, we're done dinner. Kids, my daughters, clear the table. And they are excused. They don't get up until they're excused. And when they get excused, they excuse to clear the table and then stack the dishes for the adults to do the washing. And as time goes on, they'll do more of those chores. But this is their own load.
Yeah.
That they are carrying as members of the family. So there's a distinction that you might find helpful, Salem, in kind of maneuvering with, I don't know if it's your situation or your friend's situation, but maneuvering that.
Great, yes. And actually, when now looking at it, seeing that verse, I was just seeing it in 1 Peter 4:9, to be hospitable one with another without begrudging, it does suggest that it's both sides being hospitable, not just one side.
Right. And there's...
Okay, great.
Yeah, and there are people who are going to take advantage of that, no question. And we call that enablement. I don't know if there's an exact verse that uses the phrase, but you see aspects of this kind of surfacing in the book of Proverbs regarding the lazy person. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And if laziness is a vice, I don't see why we have a moral obligation to enable the vice, because we're contributing to it. And then this Galatians passage, I think, gives us some broader principles that will be helpful, and also the 2 Thessalonians. I don't have that right in front of me, but H.I. Thessalonians chapter 3. Where is it? Here. If anyone is not willing to work, then he is not to eat either. So there we have it. For we hear that some among you are leading an undisciplined life, doing no work at all, but acting like busybodies. Now such persons we command and exhort in the Lord Jesus Christ to work in a quiet fashion and eat your own bread.
That's pretty clear.
Yeah, I think so. It's interesting that when Paul is talking a couple verses earlier, he talks about his own example, and he wants them, the Thessalonians, to follow his example, because we did not, verse 7 of chapter 3, we did not act in an undisciplined manner among you, nor did we eat anyone's bread without paying for it. But with labor and hardship, we kept working night and day so that we would not be a burden to any of you. And so there's your context there. I think that big chunk of that chapter applies to the circumstance that you're facing right now.
Great. That's great. Thank you so much, Greg. I appreciate it being pointed in the direction there. I'm going to look up those verses to find some more that correlate.
Well, give my and my wife's best to your good wife and family, okay?
Oh, for sure. Thanks.
Pleasure to talk to you again.
You too. Take care.
Au revoir.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. That's a good call. Let's go to break, and I'll come back with more of your calls here on Stand to Reason.
Stand to Reason with Greg Kokel is now a TV show. With an added level of interaction, see Greg in his element and follow discussions with on-screen questions. Tune in to NRB, National Religious Broadcasters, every Wednesday night at 11 p.m. Pacific Time, 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Available on DirecTV, Google Play, and Roku. And don't forget, you can always set your DVR to record the program so you can enjoy it whenever you'd like. You can find STR-TV on Wednesday nights at 11 p.m. Pacific Time, 2 a.m. Eastern Time on DirecTV, Google Play, and Roku. STR-TV, Christianity worth thinking about.
Would you like brief, easily digestible answers to some of the challenges you face as a Christian ambassador? Well, that's why we created our Ambassador's Guide series of booklets. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. With these booklets, you'll receive concise and approachable guides to various philosophies like pluralism and postmodernism, world religions such as Islam and Mormonism, even strategies on how to answer the challenges of the new atheists. To order a booklet from the Ambassador's Guide series, visit our online store at str.org. or call 800-2-REASON.
All right, plenty of room on the lines here on Stand to Reason. The number is 855 243-9975. Now, that's only for those of you listening live, which would be Tuesday evenings from 3 until 7 Los Angeles time. That's when we're doing our live broadcast, though many, I'm sorry, 4 until, 3 until 7, that's 4 hours. 3 hours is enough. 4 until 7, thank you, Tom, for that correction. 4 until 7 Pacific Daylight Time now, and you could dial that number, 855-243-9975. Incidentally, if you're out of the country, like our last caller, Salem, who was in France, you can dial 562, make that 1-562-424-8229, and you'll get the switchboard, and we'll be able to put you through. All right, I have to apologize to Isaac, because I've dumped you twice now, Isaac. And my apologies, young man, and fortunately you're an old-timer here with us, so you know the routine. I sometimes push the wrong button. So
Yeah, it's not even that hard of a question, so I don't know why you're trying to get out of it. It's a pleasure to talk to you again, Greg.
Thank you.
As I was saying, this is kind of just a curiosity for me. I kind of have my own opinion, but I'd like to hear what yours is. Should we be okay watching two guys or women and a guy or whatever? I don't know. Maybe that has something to do with it. But let's just say it's two guys in like a UFC fight, just, you know, pummeling each other into bloody pulps, you know. I don't know. Is there something wrong with that?
Were you talking about the NFL or the AFC now?
No, UFC, the Ultimate Fighting, okay. You know, like the MMA.
That was just kind of a joke.
Oh, got it.
So this, because your question covers more ground than probably you anticipated. So I'm it's a fair question, and I will tell you, I have never been asked this question before. Okay.
Awesome.
So this is a first time for me, and I have not given it a lot of thought. I will tell you that on the one hand, what did you call it? The UFC. It's called the Ultimate
Fighting Champion.
Yes. Whatever. The UFC. These things, like almost like pounding to the death type inside the cage and all of that. This is beyond me. I mean, I don't have the stomach for that kind of thing. Occasionally, I've seen a little bit of it on TV, though I have been more interested in boxing, and I did box for a while, more from the training perspective, not to knock somebody out. But and boxing by itself does not affect me the same way as these cage fights do. But at this point, I'm just talking about my own kind of emotional sensibilities. Your question is a moral question, and the moral question, right?
And I mean, I'm feeling it. Yeah, it. My question comes from what may just be my own emotional response as well, and I kind of feel comforted that you mentioned that, because you know I feel like it's kind of punch off of my man card if I'm not able to watch UFC or something, or if I think it's barbaric or whatever, you know, like, yeah. Oh, geez, come on. So
I do think it is somewhat barbaric, but this is where it becomes difficult to draw the line. Very few people think the NFL is barbaric. But I know a little bit about what happens on a playing field, or let me put it this way. I know what happens to professional football players a few years after they quit playing football. Their bodies disintegrate. Their joints fall apart. Joe Namath has got two knee replacements. He walks with canes. I mean, just to mention one guy that I know from my era, way back when, 45 years ago or whatever. And football is a brutal sport. And it is meant to be brutal. That is, the goal of football is to have bodies clash together. And, I should say the goal is to get a goal, I guess, would be more accurate. But the way that is accomplished is by having bodies clash together. That would be like saying the goal of fighting is really just to knock a guy out. But in order to knock the guy out, you got to punch him a bunch of times. So, or to tap out, you know, in the case of the cage fighting stuff. So, is it wrong to engage in sports that could be physically damaging? And I guess I wouldn't say categorically yes, because look at hockey, for goodness sake. Right. All of these sports take a toll on you. Well, maybe the dividing line, and I'm thinking a little out loud and working through this myself here as I'm talking, Isaac. So maybe the dividing line is when you purposefully, or the point of the game is to hurt somebody and to maim them. Well, I don't think the point of boxing is to maim somebody. I think the point of boxing is to knock the person out. And the point of football isn't to maim somebody, it's to make a goal. But both of them entail behaviors to accomplish that goal that are physically, what's the right word now, extreme. You're banging into people. You're throwing your body around. You're throwing elbows. You're crashing people into the boards. So I guess I don't think that that's entirely wrong, but I do think that there is a point at which it seems like you go too far. I mean, gladiators use weapons. And I didn't know this until fairly recently when I actually studied a little bit about gladiators, but most gladiators did not fight to the death. If that were the case, you'd run out of gladiators pretty quickly. They were fought to submission and in ways that sometimes injured them, but they did not fight to the death most of the time.
Well, when you say injure, I mean kind of like on news stories, however many were injured, I mean, that injury, they could have lost a leg, right?
Well, I'm not sure about the, in the case of the gladiators, if you lose a leg as a gladiator, you're out of play too. But I think they'd get, you know, they'd take their slashes and cuts and bruises and bangs and maybe broken bones and the like. And the same thing happens in football. Now, the reason I draw the comparison, Isaac, is because people would not normally, I think most people would think about gladiators and think that that's barbaric. Even if they didn't fight to the death, but fought to submission. Mm-hmm. But they would not think the NFL is barbaric, you know. A lot of people would think that, you know, boxing is barbaric, but they wouldn't think that hockey is barbaric, though boxing is, you know, a part of the game, as it turns out, of sorts. Fighting is a part of the game. Not an official, but it is part of the appeal and the attraction and the intensity of the game. So here's where I get uncomfortable. I get uncomfortable when it seems that people are causing pain for the sake of the pain and are relishing in the idea of injuring someone else. And that could happen in football, hockey, boxing, kickboxing, UFC stuff. But I think that virtually all of those sports could be pursued without having that intention, with the possibility maybe of the UFC stuff. Because
right.
that just seems too wild to me. And even the idea that they're in a cage, you know, I think all of this is meant to recall the ancient gladiators. And I think that there's a kind of a prurient interest of sorts that is being appealed to. I'm not sure if the word prurient means sexual necessarily. That's usually where it's used, but maybe just illicit. Appeals to us in an illicit way. And maybe that's why you and I both are troubled by these things.
In my mind, that there's a skill involved, obviously. I'm not, someone could claim that it's about the skill, but, you know, I wouldn't want to see fencers without any gear with, you know, the completely sharp pointed edges.
Yeah, right.
Going at each other, you know, until there's a certain loss of blood.
Sure.
And so, right. And so that's why, I mean, boxing is one thing, but to me, the whole UFC thing, and then, I don't know. And then also it's like, there's, I think we would, I don't know if death is the line either, because, you know, even if someone's not dead, if they've, you know, been
mutilated somewhere.
Yeah. So, I don't know, I'm just trying to.
Yeah, I don't know. I think this is one of those things where you kind of have to work through it. People do get killed in boxing. I used to love watching a boxer named Boom Boom Mancini. This was 20, 30 years ago, and Mancini fought a Korean guy and killed him in the ring and quit as a result. It was just too hard. And but he was, and here's a case where I enjoyed watching this boxer for his capability, his dogged capability. You know, he just stayed in the ring and just kept boxing. And Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, later Muhammad Ali, Cassius Clay was poetry in motion, you know, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. And he was, you know, he knocked out Sonny Liston in that incredible, 3-minute match. So he was, there was artistry involved, even though you had somebody getting punched. I sometimes am attracted to the boxing because for that reason, seeing it. I don't want to see people get hurt. I don't mind them getting knocked out. I was knocked out once by a punch, knocked down. I almost went out cold by a shot to the solar plexus, and I just went down like a rock, man. Actually, my sparring partner caught me as I went down. He didn't mean to hurt me, but, man, it was like I was just like that. I was gone. So, you know, there is this element of sport. You're willing to put up with a little bit of physical abuse. This is true of every sport, just that is even marginally contact.
Right.
Basketball is like that, for goodness sake. And so, but then there just seems to be a line. Maybe that line is different for different people, but if one is going, wow, did you see that? The blood spurted all, you know, that kind of thing. One wonder if one is taking pleasure in the wrong thing in that fight. And
right.
Do you remember the movie Gladiator? Did you see the movie Gladiator?
Oh, Russell Crowe?
Yeah, with Russell Crowe.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And then there is this, you know, all the fighting is going on. That big scene where Russell Crowe, afterwards, he reveals who he actually is. And so it's a magnificent scene, bit of filmmaking. But there's this ghastly bloodletting in that film. And it's like people are cheering more for the bloodletting. And it's, oh, wow, did you see that? Whoa, that's what we come here for. That kind of approach to me is over the top.
I think it says something if, you know, you go to a UFC fight and it only lasts 10 minutes and, you know, there wasn't any blood spilt and it was just kind of jujitsu tapping, you know. It's like, oh, man, that was lame. No one, you know, got hospitalized.
Yeah.
So,
see, now that might reveal something. If what one is looking for is that kind of thing. I think when people watch someone like Cassius Clay, or any of those fighters, I don't know what it's like now. I don't follow that so much. But you're looking for a skill, and you see this kind of physical artistry in motion, and it's there's something that's I don't know if noble is the right word, but you appreciate from an aesthetic perspective the execution of one's capabilities as an artist there, and the fact that it's boxing generally does not take away from that because people aren't getting their heads literally knocked off.
Right. I mean,
they're just getting knocked out. And that's part of the – people get knocked out on the football field all the time. And there are rules that govern excess, so there's no serious injury, although getting pounded in the head for a long time, it does mess you up. And even boxers, you know, get a little bit punchy after a while.
I can imagine.
So anyway, that's my point of view. I guess there are people that are probably listening to us who are going to say, you know, Jesus would never go to a boxing match and he'd never approve of that kind of thing. And so if what would Jesus do? And maybe they'd have a point. I don't know. But it doesn't.
I was thinking of something a little bit more philosophical, but I mean That could be it, too.
Well, so I didn't get philosophical enough for you, huh?
No, I mean, The answer of what would Jesus do, I'm not sure. I guess I'd have to ask the person who would say that.
Well, see, I do have a concern about that approach, WWJD, because a lot of times people will answer that question according to their own cultural sensibilities. Would Jesus have gone to a football game on the Sabbath? No, he would not have gone to a football game. Therefore, we shouldn't go to a football game on the Sabbath. You know, In fact, the book In His Steps, where the phrase "What would Jesus do?" came from, there are a number of occasions in there where decisions are made based on what Jesus would do that are clearly, in my view, influenced by the fundamentalist religious culture that that author found himself in, and so it was unthinkable for him that Jesus would do certain things that were inconsistent with what I thought turned out to be practices of his religious culture. Didn't have anything to do with really Jesus, what Jesus might have done. And so I don't know that that is always a legitimate or reliable guide in the conversation. What would Jesus do? I'll tell you one thing, though, that that I do feel strongly about the WWJD, what would Jesus do, is you have to know WDJD, that is, what did Jesus do, before you would know what would Jesus do. That is, anybody who's wearing the bracelet is going to be simply lost if they are not a student of the Gospels.
That's true.
A lot of people are wearing the bracelet or used to, and they didn't know what Jesus did. They just have a sentimentalist understanding of Jesus, and so they say, well, what would Jesus do? Well, he would never do anything unloving. And then they interpret loving and unloving according to the patterns of the day here, you know what I'm saying? And he'd never say anybody's a sinner. That's unloving, and Jesus wouldn't be unloving, and that kind of thing. And so here the cultural issues start to play a part. Anyway, there you go, Isaac.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for asking your question. And maybe the response wasn't quite so intellectual, but that's best I had. I'll do some more thinking about that. Appreciate your call. All right, that's it for our hour, friends. More coming up on Stand to Reason. Please stay with us. I'm Greg Kokel. Hello, friends. Greg Kokel here. Stand to Reason is the show, and I appreciate you being part of the audience here today. And I look forward to talking with you if you'd like to give me a ring. 855-243-9975 is the number here during our live broadcast hours from 4 until 7. Now, I said give me a ring, and it's kind of an ironic way of starting because I want to offer some thoughts about a wedding I just was at. It was a family member. My niece got married. And weddings are special. And it doesn't matter who it is that's getting married, although I should pause for a second. I do think all weddings are special, all right. But it's been a long time since I've been to a wedding, now I think about it, where the people were not Christian who are getting married. And maybe my comments here largely are influenced by my experience with Christian weddings, understanding the significance of those weddings and the nature of what is being promised and the gravity with which those vows are being made, which I do think, frankly, is more so, that is, there's more gravity for the follower of Christ than for the person who is not. I'm not saying that non-Christians can't be utterly sincere, but just in general, in it seems that the emphasis and the value system is a bit different in the culture at large than it is for those who are committed followers of Christ. I know people have made comparisons between so-called Christians or the church and the non-church, and they look alike about the same and all these metrics, but that's misleading because just because somebody has self-identified as a Christian does not mean that they are following Christ, and the numbers look a lot better for Christians who are actually following Jesus than those who aren't. Nevertheless, my that was just a qualifier. I get touched at weddings, and there are in different ways, and that was true this weekend as well. I as I sat with my family, this isn't always the case, but the women were already getting emotional just as the music was starting and no one was moving down the aisle. And I didn't feel particularly moved until the bride made her entrance. And I don't know how to describe it or why it's the case, but there is something noble in my mind about the audience getting to their feet and turning to look down the aisle to show respect and honor for the woman who is entering the room. What is that? I don't know. But I thought, I'm going to be okay here. I'm not going to get emotional at this wedding. And when I stood up, there I went. It was touching. And these kind of events are touching for other reasons, too, because you see two people who are, in a certain sense, emotionally naked and unafraid. They are facing each other before a large company of people who know them, friends and family, and before whom they are saying very personal, weighty, emotionally profound things to each other. And usually this can be heard by everybody because they're mic'd in some way. Occasionally vows are given privately, but the vows are really made publicly so for everyone to hear. And there is a kind of standard set of vows to have and to hold, etc., till death do us part, forsaking all others. But it is common nowadays for there to be an additional set of vows that are given that are personal, in which very, very personal statements are made, the groom to the bride and the bride to the groom. And it is hard to hear these things and not be touched by what is being said, by the emotions and the convictions that are being communicated at the time. And then, as the vows are given and the message offered by the pastor, and this is why I think it's particularly significant when there are Christian followers of Christ who are getting married, because the pastor generally has something very poignant and specific and oftentimes politically incorrect to say about these relationships, identifying the God-given purpose of marriage, the proper roles of husband to wife, the commitments that are being made, the part role of the community in establishing the marriage and holding each person's feet to the fire, so to speak. There's going to be a lot, I think, more substantive that is said by a pastor who has a strong commitment to biblical principles than by a justice of the peace, or maybe a pastor who's just celebrating the love of these two lovely people standing before him. But what happens, I think, for an audience, and this is a good thing, though it is somewhat painful, what happens is that those who are in the audience who are married have an opportunity to review their own pledges and their own commitments to their spouses, sometimes pledges and commitments that were made years and years before, and reflect. And this is often a painful enterprise. In fact, I would go so far to say it isn't just often a painful enterprise. I would suspect that it is difficult for any married person who is thoughtful about these things and self-reflective, and who are people of virtue and care about fulfilling pledges, being virtuous spouses and the like. It is difficult for any of them to listen to the new vows of this couple being married without suffering a bit of conviction, because the things that are said on a wedding day and the vows that are taken are so lofty that one can't hear them without realizing how far short he or she has fallen in the years since they've been married. This happened to me, and I think it happened to everybody. Vows are meant to be ideals, shoot for the stars, as it were, but it is a sobering thing when one considers that sitting in the gallery, as it were, and thinks about their own relationship. And I think under the best of circumstances, it causes us to reflect and reassess and ask ourselves, not are we keeping those lofty vows, because no one does them perfectly. And as Francis Schaeffer said, all utopian expectations turn out to be cruel in the end because they can never be fulfilled. Nevertheless, it's a good thing to shoot for the stars. It is a good thing to pursue those expectations, to aim high, and then periodically reflect and reassess and make course adjustments. In this regard, though, I remember something I saw on a movie many, many, many years ago, and I was channel surfing as a single person and happened upon an old black and white film in which I saw one short scene, and I don't even know what the film was, who the actors were, but the scene stands out because of what was said. They were a man and a woman looking at a book, standing up, looking at something written in a book, and the man read what was in there and then read it a second time. And it stuck with me because it was something they both were reflecting on in the movie. And the phrase was, a man's life is like a diary in which he means to write one story, but he writes another. A man's life is like a diary in which he means to write one story, but he writes another. And every person who stands at an altar has a story in mind that they plan to write. And the story that is, the life that is lived is never like the story that they plan to write. I'm not saying that it falls short of that. I'm saying that it's different. And in some ways, it almost always falls short of our expectation. In other ways, it's much better than our expectations. Most of the things in my life are actually better than I anticipated them being. maybe when I was a college kid. I didn't really have much of a trajectory in mind, but when I think of the things that I've been able to participate in, the people I know, the relationships that I have, the work that I've been able to do, all of these things, it's a better story than I was planning to write for myself without Christ, that's for sure. But regardless, weddings are an opportunity when we sit in them to be reminded that we meant to write one story. Now we're living another story, maybe better, maybe worse, but a reminder to readjust to the goals and lofty things that were part of that wedding ceremony, yet at the same time being sober-minded enough to know that it doesn't work out always that way. And here is where I wanted to mention something that my niece mentioned at the wedding. Now, I have two nieces, and one was being married, the younger one. The eldest, 4 or 5 years her senior, has been married already for a number of years, has one child, and is going to have another soon. She was the matron of honor, and as is often the custom during the reception, the members of the wedding party make a toast. Oftentimes there wasn't any alcohol here, so there are no toasts, but there were things that were said and confident and encouragements shared during the meal by different members of the wedding party. And in this case, Lauren, the eldest, gave a word to Lindsay, and there were many things in it which were wonderful, and I was glad that my own daughters were listening. Actually, my six-year-old wasn't paying that much attention, but my nine-year-old was, and I'm looking into the future, hoping, trusting that the kind of friendship that was expressed in the words between my nieces would be one that would eventually be uniformly expressed between my daughters. And if you're parents of kids, you know what I'm talking about, parents of younger children. But something that Lauren, the elder sister, said stuck out for me, and it is quite simple, but I appreciated so much the comment given in the context of a wedding in which there is so much triumphalism kind of and high expectations appropriately expressed. This is what you do at weddings. You look to the future, you make promises, and you shoot for the stars. But here's what she said. Lauren said, Lindsay, the bride, Lindsay, your best years are ahead of you, and so are your worst years. And it wasn't a downer comment. It provided an appropriate sense of balance to the event. Because those of you who walk with the Lord and are married know that there is no relationship on earth that is as powerful a tool in our lives to make us more like Christ than our marriages. And indeed, there's a fabulous book. I've recommended it here before, and some of you may have read it. If not, make note of it now. It's called Sacred Marriage. And the theme of the book, which is captured in its subtitle, is maybe marriage is not designed by God to make us happy, but it's designed by God to make us holy. That's the sense of the subtitle. Maybe marriage is designed not to make us happy, but to make us holy. And it's a wake-up call to realize that God's commitment to us is to make us like Jesus. And so he's going to use the tools that are most effective for that. And I know that my own selfishness, my own self-centeredness, my own ego, my own egotism, all of the above and more have been profoundly challenged by not being a husband and being a father. And these are things that are not fun to have challenged. All discipline for the moment seems not to be joyful but sorrowful. Hebrews 12. But afterwards, for those who have been trained by it, yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness. So we go through the discipline in our lives, and God uses the relationships around us for that purpose. These are for a good end, is what the writer of Hebrews is communicating there in the first half of chapter 12. There's a lot there. It's worth reading. But I think that marriage is one of those relationships where this kind of thing happens in spades. And that's a good thing. And it's God's design. And at weddings, we should celebrate and shoot for the stars and say our vows and mean them and seek to keep them and commit as a community ourselves to that couple, that we will do what we can to help them to keep the lofty promises they've made. But it's also, and it's also a time for us to reflect on that as well, but also a time to be aware, as the matron of honor did in honoring her sister, offering that word, yes, the best of times are ahead of you, but also the worst of times. And not worst in being bad, evil, but worst in being hard and challenging, and good in the hard challenge, because that is the very thing that God is using to conform us to the image of his Son. And here we are at that wonderful verse that is not usually quoted in its entirety from Romans 8, and let me close my thoughts with it then. Romans 8, 28 and I think 29, here's the whole thing. We know that God causes all things to work for the good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. For those whom he foreknew, he predestined to become conformed to the image of his Son. And there's the telos. There's the end. There's the goal. There's the purpose. God will work all things for our good. He's going to cause them to work together for those of us who are called according to his purpose, in the sense that he will use them to make us more like Christ, which is the best end imaginable. All right, I'm Greg Kokel. This is Stand to Reason. I'll have your calls in just a moment.
You can find STR on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians. Want to know what is going on with STR? Speaking events, new podcasts, resources, and articles? Follow STR online. You can find all of our social media connections at str.org.
Don't forget, Stand to Reason's live broadcast is Tuesdays, 4 to 7 p.m. on the web. That's Pacific time, by the way. So go to str.org to listen live, or use your STR app to stream it live. You can also give me a piece of your mind by calling at that time, Tuesdays, 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific time. Here's the number, 855-243-9975. And, of course, you can listen on the radio, like always, on Sundays, 2 to 5 p.m. Pacific time. But for the live broadcast, tune in online Tuesdays, 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific time, by going to str.org. Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason, and got a couple of questions lined up here. So let's go to our callers, and in Ohio, Dan, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Real quick, I'm at work, so if I happen to disappear, it's because I had to go, but I'm going to get to, let me hash this out real quick.
All right.
I've always had a little bit of trouble, even though I've been in the Christian for many years. I've taught the Bible. Of course, you can't know it all, but I've been trying to hash out the question of, the Calvinistic view, not Calvin himself, but the type of view that God's sovereign, God's choice. Now, I listened to John MacArthur, and he has a wonderful dissertation on it, but I'm still kind of stuck, because I wrote a few things down. And I know Matthew says it, by your words you'll either, and I can't remember where it's at exactly, but by your words you'll either go to heaven or you're not. Now,
Jesus said, you shall be justified, and by your words you shall be condemned. I think that was Jesus. Or he said, every idle word that you speak, one will give an account of in the day of judgment. But I think he had something very specific in mind when he made those comments. I don't know if you want me to comment on that or not, or there's something else more front
well,
and center
I do, but
for you.
I think that's just a part of my problem, and I kind of figured it was probably a context thing as far as that goes. But I know the scripture says that no one comes to the Father unless he is called. All that come to the Father, and then another verse that says, all that the Father gives me, I lose none. Now, I'm probably getting these a little wrong, but sorry.
No, you're right. Raise up on the last day. Right. That's John 6, yeah. My sheep hear my voice. Right, that's John 10.
Okay. And then it seems to me like we're justified by we justify our condemnation by our rejection of God in one sense, but we can't be just, it seems like we can't be justified by our condemnation if we weren't called in the first place. How does that hash out?
Well, I think I know what you're getting at. Let me try to just to address in general, and then you tell me if I'm addressing your question itself. Biblical, Orthodox, classical Christian theology holds that human beings are fallen from the womb. That is, in virtue of the fall of Adam, humans are born broken. And that brokenness manifests itself in rebellion. This, by the way, is biblical anthropology. It is not Calvinistic or Reformed theology alone. It is Arminian theology as well. This is Christian theology. And for one to deny the fall and the inherent brokenness of man is to go off the reservation theologically. In the 4th century, at the time of Augustine, there was a teacher named Pelagius, and he held an errant or heretical view of this. He said there was no fall and that we are each responsible for our own fall. So classical Christianity...
That would be by works, then.
Yes, exactly. So classical Christianity holds that that one is fallen from the womb but held responsible for his rebellion against God and properly under judgment for the crimes that he commits against God and also for suppressing the truth of God with unrighteous motives, and that's in Romans chapter 1, okay? So now how do we get rescued from this? And this is where you start to see a diversion. All Orthodox, and I mean small O Orthodox Christians, teach that only Jesus can rescue us. And we need his work on the cross to rescue us from the Father, the right. Punishment that the Father has given. So, okay, now, but we're lost. We're slaves to sin. We're slaves to Satan. We are spiritually dead. We are disconnected from the life that only God can give. We're unplugged. So if we're unplugged, we don't have the power to plug ourselves back in. We are suppressing the truth in unrighteousness. We are not seeking God. We are held captive by the enemy to do his will. The whole world lies in the power of the evil one. And all I'm doing is quoting Bible verses that you probably are familiar with to show that we're
Does everybody have the access to the plug? Is I guess is what.
I'm working up to that. Okay.
Okay.
We're in deep yogurt, to put it simply. We're in trouble, and we need to be rescued. Okay. Now at this point, everybody agrees who's on the reservation theologically, but then there is a divergence because we all agree that God has to act to rescue us. And not just act by sending Jesus. He's got to act on us. He's got to do something on us individually to rescue us. And here's the way I put it, and I think simplifies the two views in a way I think that we can manage them and keep them distinct. We all agree God's got to act. The question then is how much does God act? Does he act on us to bring us halfway, or does he act on us to bring us the whole way? And when I say halfway, all I mean is that he works in such a way as offering grace to human beings so that human beings are somewhat neutral and then can decide one way or the other for themselves. Without God's grace, we are always going to decide against God. Okay? So Arminians generally would say, well, God is going to give enough grace so that you are neutral and you get to break the tie. All right. And a reformed person like a Calvinist will say, no, God is going to give grace to rescue completely. And that's completely in God's hand, but he doesn't give it to everybody. So the Arminian would say everybody gets half grace, where the Calvinist would say not everybody gets full grace. And that's where the difference lies. Both argue that human beings, or they both hold that human beings are guilty. They are worthy of the blame that's placed on them, and they will be punished for their crimes against God.
Okay.
The Calvinists will say God just passes over those that he does not choose to bring into his kingdom as a bride for Christ and lets them do what they want, which is to continue rebelling, and then he judges them at the end. That's not his fault that they're rebelling. It's their fault, and they are being punished for their rebellion. And those who get saved are saved because of God's grace and God's grace alone, which is unmerited. And so God's fully responsible for their salvation. On the Arminian side, those who go to hell because they chose, in spite of a measure of God's grace, to reject his offer, his approach to them, however that is, whether it's through nature or through the specific gospel of Jesus. Either way, they're still guilty for rejecting it. And if they accept, then they get the benefit of Jesus in virtue of their libertarian free will choice. So in both cases, you have those who reject are guilty for their rejection, and those who accept Christ get the benefits of Christ. The difference is just in the details of how much of how the grace of God is working in each case.
But of course, these views I know are widely debated, and I'm leaning more towards the sovereign choice of God. Of course, he mm-hmm. always has the choice.
The Reformed view.
The Reformed
view. John MacArthur's view.
Because
right.
there's so much scriptural text that leans in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
I guess in everything that you explained, it seemed to be, okay, here's the views, pick one. And I'm trying.
Yeah.
I can't seem to grasp, I grasp more on the Calvinistic viewpoint
yes.
or the Reformed viewpoint than anything else.
Right.
Because of the scriptures that are laid out for us and they're so easily understood as God's got the choice here.
Uh-huh.
And a few of the things that I alluded to earlier about all that God gave the Son, he loses none.
Uh-huh.
And I'm thinking, well, if that's the case, how does someone get missed or be stepped over? And I know that's God's sovereign choice, and it's his business to step over those
yeah,
if he wants to.
In Ephesians says it's through the kind intention of his will that he rescued some. Now, and this is where I think this gets emotionally difficult, and I am with you in that I hold a Reformed view of salvation because I think that this is most consistent with most of the scriptures that speak to this, and that there are some
right.
passages like the John 6 and the John 10 passages that are so straightforward that as to be almost unequivocal. I cannot imagine these verses read in a non-Reformed sense without doing serious injustice to the passages. Now, look, there are other passages that you could read the other direction. I realize that. I just have to look at what seemed like the preponderance of Scripture. So I hold
right.
the view I hold, although I am emotionally uncomfortable with it in a certain fashion.
Which we don't necessarily have the right to be.
Well, I'm not examining that. I'm not going to beat myself up for feeling uncomfortable.
Well, yeah,
about
what I mean
it,
by that is that the whole idea of we work in a visual way, I guess, and we see things as fair and unfair. And you said it earlier about cultural milieus, but if it doesn't seem fair that God would skip anybody, I think don't want to act like that or think that way because I know that God's choice.
Let me ask
choice,
you a question.
No right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Sure. Yeah. And so, so we, you know, we have our emotional response. We tried then to, we try to instruct our emotions sometimes with the truth. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. To me, the most important thing is that we affirm what we have good reason to believe the truth is, even though emotionally we're not always comfortable with it. Incidentally, sometimes that subjective response that we're having should not be ignored, because there are times when, you know, there is, I'll just call it an intuition right now, and I'm using that term in a philosophic sense. There's a deep awareness we have of a truth that seems to be inconsistent with what our reading of the text is or our theology, and that might be a wake-up call to maybe take a second look at our theology. And so, you know, we can hold these convictions with a little bit of a loose grip if they are troubling to us for a good reason. I'm not saying we abandon them, but if they're troubling to us for a good reason, then we want to be aware of that and alert to that. Ultimately, go ahead.
Well, there's sometimes I have, we all have doubts, like you've related before, but sometimes I think, well, if I'm having trouble with this, then God is working in my heart, so I know that, and I have scripture to actually back that up. Then I have these, even though I'm not extremely concerned about my salvation in the sense that am I saved or am I not? Because I believe that I am, because we have the witness of the Holy Spirit with me.
And plus you fulfilled the requirements. Plus you fulfilled the requirements,
right,
which is putting your faith and trust and your confidence in God's rescuer, Jesus
right.
of Nazareth.
But
so
my trouble, I guess, is the good folks that I run into on a regular basis that have such a deep concern for this. I don't have an adequate answer, and I don't know that I ever will, but I mean...
Well, did you ever think of this, and I don't know if this addresses the issue so much, because I can see people's reluctance to want to think that God saved some rather than others, and why didn't he save them all? Did it ever bother you that God never saved any of the fallen angels? That there was no salvation plan of any kind for any fallen angels?
Yeah, I have thought about that quite often.
Okay, well, I've never talked to anybody for whom that bothered, okay?
Well, it bothers me in the sense that it's part and parcel to the problem that I'm having with this flip-flopping, am I sure, am I not sure, not about salvation, but am I... Which viewpoint is actually accurate?
Yeah.
And how do I justify it one way or the other?
Right. Well, this is where I think you have to go back to the text. And I think especially those passages you just mentioned, the John 6 and then the John 10. But it's not just those. There's a lot of other passages that seem directly to be related to God sovereignly working. Because of those passages, I have to come down on the side of the Reformed view, even though I understand how people are unsettled by it. And then they ask the question, why didn't God save everybody? And, of course, that's a question that could be asked of either side. Well, on the Arminian view, why didn't God save anybody? Because he made the rule that you have to freely choose him. Well, why did he make that rule? Why didn't he just save them without making that rule? You know, you can always advance that kind of objection, it seems to me.
Well, I've always answered it with the thought that, God knows the end from the beginning, and he knows who will choose them. I've always answered it that way, but then I've heard arguments that refute that pretty well.
Well, that is not what election is. Election is not prescience. It isn't knowing in advance. Foreknowledge isn't knowing beforehand. Omniscience is knowing beforehand. Foreknowledge is synonymous with election, because Jesus was...
Romans 8.
And there's a number of places where you see this. Notice that Jesus was foreknown from before the foundations of the world. That doesn't mean that God knew what Jesus was going to do and he died on a cross. That means it was the plan of God that he would do that. So foreknowledge, in this sense, is a synonym for election, however you want to construe the election. It is not God knowing something beforehand. That is an unfortunate result of the way the words sound, you know. He knows the people. He doesn't know the acts. Let me back up. Of course he knows the acts, but that's not what the statement is making. Those whom he foreknew, he be destined to become conformed to the image of his son, the Romans 8 passage. So he is foreknowing the people. He is not foreknowing the actions. That's not what the verse is talking about. So foreknowledge is a word that is synonymous with election. And I think when you look more closely at that word, those words, that becomes more evident. And I don't know what to say. You know, I'm not the least bit troubled that God had no rescue plan for fallen angels. They're despicable things. But look at human beings are fallen as well. And what did God do with human beings? Well, he saved some. And then we count it, we are tempted to think of it as a vice. So that is, nothing wrong with him saving no fallen despicable angels, but when it comes to human beings, he decides to save some fallen despicable human beings. Well, then that's a vice. He should have saved us all.
Great.
And so I'm choosing to see it on the grace side. You know, it's unmerited either way. And the thing that troubles me, and I'll just leave this out there, Dan, because I don't have an answer for it. The thing that troubles me isn't God's election. It is the nature of the fall and the fact that we're born fallen. I'm in a sense, I'd feel more comfortable with Pelagius's view that we each kind of bear our own guilt, that we're all born like Adam was created, morally neutral and morally pure, and then if we you know, falter, that then we have no one to blame but ourselves. As it turns out, though, we are born into a fallen race, and the ramifications that apply to that, and that's the part that troubles me. Angels didn't have that because they didn't reproduce.
We have to lean a little more, I guess, sometimes on the fact that the miracle is the grace that even chose us at all.
Yeah. So one other way to put it is, the thing that bothers me the most theologically is the thing that everybody from both sides of the aisle, from the full range of theological perspectives within the pale of Orthodox Christianity, it's the thing that they all believe in, and that is original sin. That's the thing that's troublesome to me, not that God would rescue some and not others.
I guess we got to start with that and say that, you know, the scriptures lean towards this particular view so much so that it's kind of hard to not see it that way.
Yeah.
Understanding it and explaining it,
that's different.
That takes a long time.
Yeah, yeah, if ever. And this is where, for me, my biblical anthropology drives my biblical soteriology. That is, my biblical understanding of man and man's fall is what informs the nature of the cross, the work of the cross, how we benefit from it. All right, Dan, good talking to you. Thanks for asking the question.
All right, take care.
Okay, I appreciate that. Let's go to break. I'm Greg Kokel.
I'm J. Warner Wallace, and I'd like to commend to you, if I can be so bold, a book I've written that'll help you examine the evidence for the Christian worldview. It's called Cold Case Christianity. My hope here is to give you 10 principles of cold case investigations that'll help you examine the claims of the Gospels. I've also given a 4-part template that'll help you examine the Gospels from the perspective of eyewitness reliability. Can you trust what the gospel writers told us? Were they written early enough to have been written by true eyewitnesses? Have they been changed over the years? Is there any way to corroborate what's been written in the gospels? And finally, is there some bias held by the gospel writers which would preclude them from being trustworthy eyewitnesses? I hope Cold Case Christianity will give you insight from the perspective of a detective. You can purchase Cold Case Christianity by visiting the Stand to Reason store at str.org.
The most practical thing you can understand in order to answer the challenges of skeptics and critics is the Bible. It's God's revelation that we represent to others. You can get a better grasp of God's history of redemption in Greg Kokel's video series, The Bible Fast Forward. The Bible Fast Forward gives a practical, historical overview of the Old Testament, emphasizing the unfolding plan of salvation as God reveals it through his covenants with the nation of Israel and the fulfillment of those covenants in the person of Jesus of Nazareth. You'll gain an understanding of how the central topical elements of the Christian story of reality play out historically from the fall to the cross. I'm convinced you'll gain a clearer understanding of the important themes of the Bible when you study the Bible Fast Forward. You can order this DVD curriculum that includes a comprehensive study guide by visiting STR's store online at str.org. Give us a call at 800-2-REASON or visit str.org to order the Bible Fast Forward.
Well, the issue of salvation we talked about last caller, it's, I've said this many times, and I'm just going to say it again. Life is not tidy, and theology is not tidy, and the Bible's not tidy, and Christianity is not tidy. There are lots of loose ends. And I really don't hold out forever being able to tie all of those loose ends off nice and neatly this side of the resurrection. I have to go to back to the text and do the best that I can with trying to understand these things taught in the text, taking into consideration the full counsel of God. And I don't mean there the sense of balance where you take a little bit of this and a little bit of that, you take a little bit of grace and you can take a little bit of law, and grace and law balance each other out. No, that's not what I mean at all. What I mean is that we take the text, we take the full counsel of the Scripture on it, and we try to come up with a coherent doctrine that reflects as much as possible that full counsel, knowing that there's going to be outliers, knowing that there's going to be verses that don't seem to fit in. And I don't know what to do with them. It's the best we can do. I don't want to go with the minority report. In other words, I don't want to go with the minority verses and then somehow capitalize on those and ignore the majority. I'm going to try to go with the majority report, so to speak. And I don't see that we have any other choice. Like I said, theology is not tidy. Let's go to Washington. And Holly, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Thank you.
So glad you waited so long. Thanks for your patience.
Oh, you're welcome. It didn't feel that long. So my question is regarding vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
We are planning on doing overseas missions, my mm-hmm. husband and I, and we have two boys, and so we're probably going to be, you know, in third world countries, we're assuming, and so we're looking into the issue of vaccines. And while I was reading it, I came across human cell lines used in the production of vaccines, and
right.
those come from aborted fetuses. And,
uh-huh.
you know, my first thought is this is black and white. You know, we can't use any vaccines that have used those. And then we thought, we thought about it more. We thought, well, it is a little bit more complicated than just saying, I don't know. So we wanted to hear
yeah.
from you what you think.
Well, I agree. I think it is a little bit, I think that is an overly, without being condescending, without meaning to be condescending here, I think that's an overly simplistic way of looking at it. And I actually mm-hmm. don't think it's accurate. But
okay.
I can understand the initial, wait a minute, well, that's aborted babies. I'm against abortion, so I'm not going to take advantage of some benefit that came at the cost of a baby's life. That would be a way
yeah.
of putting it, okay? I understand the sentiment completely. When I was a student at Michigan State University in 1971, my girlfriend was a medical technology student there, and she had to work oftentimes in the human necropsy labs. That is, you know, where they dissect human beings. And so once in a while, I know she was down there. I went down there to see her, and I said, let's go and have a bite to eat or something, you know. But that means I had to descend into the abyss here in this particular building at Michigan State University where all the human corpses were lying on slabs. Now, where did they get all these corpses from? In one case, there was a huge corpse. I should say a corpse that was made huge in virtue of all the chemicals in its body that I actually had to help somebody turn over on a dissection table. And that was one of the grossest things I've ever done in my life. But I asked where these bodies came from. And a lot of these bodies come from the morgue. They're unclaimed. All right. And what's interesting, though, is now I just want you to think about this. Here are human bodies, no question about that. Is one of your children in your arms right now, Holly?
Yeah, on my back.
Oh, on your back. Okay. So we had a little interference there for one. Let me see if I can get through this. These were bona fide human beings, no question, that were on the slab that had come from the morgue. These were unclaimed bodies. Now, how had they gotten in the morgue? Well, they had died somehow. They're John Doe's or whatever, you know. Nobody claimed the body. I am certain that some of the bodies that were being dissected for the sake of medical benefit actually were there because they were murdered by somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't just die on the streets or something. So their lives were taken illicitly, yet their bodies were still being made use of for medical benefit. And my girlfriend was there working away on them, dissecting them as part of her medical training. Now, I don't think it occurs to most people that if those corpses had been there because their lives were taken illicitly, that using the corpse subsequent to that would somehow make that medical student complicit in the cause of death that resulted in that body being on the slab to begin with. You follow me? Okay, so if that's the case, and I just think that's pretty straightforward, maybe these people got knocked on the head out in the alley somewhere, and now their body's on the slab and we're making benefit, but dissecting them for science's sake doesn't make us complicit in the murder of that individual. By the same token, if the corpse in question is a very, very small corpse of an equally valuable human being who is not yet born, but who had been killed illicitly through abortion, is it not still the case that we can legitimately use that corpse for some benefit that might befall someone in the future, that someone in the future might take advantage of? What do you think?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that makes sense. And my husband kind of brought up a similar line of reasoning as you just did, and we thought, well, maybe that makes sense. And I think I just need to wrestle with it more, you know.
Yeah.
But so I think I no, that makes perfect sense.
Okay, well,
we just had a few.
I was going to add a couple more thoughts, but
okay, go ahead.
And then you can weigh in with some more too. Fine, that's fine. We got some time here. This question has come up before, and I know that Christians have different. Or even people of conscience have different points of view on this, and I understand that, and I acknowledge that, and I give the nod to that. So there may be people who differ from what I've said or am saying, or maybe what you decide. It's an individual decision, but I want you to think for a moment of the Third Reich and what happened in certain concentration camps regarding medical research. I mean, the kinds of things that happened were horrendous. But there a lot was actually learned, for example, about hypothermia. That is what happens to the human body when it begins to the basal body temperature begins to plummet because you've put them in a vat of ice water, for example. These are the kinds of things that happened to people in these camps, and the information was recorded. So what do you do with the information? Our use of the information now did not cause those people to be subjected to that terrible thing. And arguably, this may be something redemptive that comes of it. It was tragic that they were subjected to this kind of medical experimentation, but maybe some good can come of it ex post facto. That means after it's all over, maybe something redemptive can come. We can take the knowledge that we gained about hypothermia there and use it to help people survive now instead of die. And that strikes me as a legitimate use of the information. Now, notice what's critical here. What's critical here is that it is the use of the medical benefit is not somehow causing more of the harm to take place. It doesn't create a market for this kind of thing in the future. Okay, let's dunk more people in cold water and see what happens to them because now people are using that technology. That is all part of the past. And as long as whatever we're doing now benefiting from the technology is not itself creating more harm in the future, then I don't see that there's any moral problems with it. Now, some people are just so offended by the way in which the hypothermia information was gathered, they don't want to have anything to do with it, and I understand that completely. that emotionally that's their reaction. But I don't think the moral equation actually requires that we not benefit from that, even though the experiments were illicit initially. And by parallel, I think that if we have some benefit, say vaccines, that come from a cell line that was developed from an aborted fetus, then some good may come of it. That's fine. It's only a problem if our use of that stuff is causing more fetuses to be aborted in the future, and that there's a direct connection to future abortions. That's when this would become morally suspect. Apart from that, I don't think there's any problem.
I agree with you 100%. So that's sort of what my other question was.
Wait, I'm sorry, miss. Could you say that again? Because I've had competition there with your...
With all the livestock. I agree with you 100%. I was sort of... My next question was going to be, is it possible that... Because we're just saying, okay, well, they used an aborted baby, then, but it's already done, so we're just going to go ahead with it. If everybody does that, I was just wondering, is it possible they're just going to say, okay, well, we'll just keep using aborted babies, and in fact, maybe we'll start asking for them, and I don't know. I was just wondering
The question.
If it's not, then that's great.
I don't see that that's the case right now, but some people are concerned about that, and so then they decide that they're not going to take the vaccines. Now, but consider the alternative then. You have children. Obviously, they're part of this phone conversation, and you have – putting them at some sort of risk by taking them to a foreign environment where diseases are present that wouldn't be here. If you do not vaccinate them, then you are putting them at risk, and they are real babies right there in your care. So you are looking at maybe a potential problem versus a real challenge that you are facing with your children, and that needs to be weighed in the balance as well.
I agree. So, yeah. Okay, thank you.
And all right, yeah.
Another time with a sort of different question about abortion, but it's a whole other topic.
So. Yes, okay, you're welcome to do that. And you got your hands full right now, Holly. I thank you for your call. That's a mom. and some kids. So, all right, let's go to Andy here. Andy in Corona, California, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome. Glad to have you on board.
So, first is I have to paint the backdrop. Did you happen to catch the news today about the Clippers owner getting pretty much ousted for his racial remarks?
Yes. In fact, my opening commentary of the first hour, I talked about that issue.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, okay. I talked about the general idea. I think the guy's a cad, and his remarks were obscene. But I thought that the actions taken were draconian, and I'm concerned about what this portends for anyone else in the future who the cultural elites deem to be bigoted in some way. That was my substance.
You know what? That was my sentiment almost exactly where I've had quite a few conversations with people, and every time I kind of get like a cockeyed look that somehow I'm agreeing with him or that I don't know, just something doesn't sit well with me when I see that someone doesn't have, I guess, the freedom to think something,
sure,
whether it's good or bad, and then get, you know, penalized in a... It just seems like there's a lot of power in that
uh-huh.
that could backfire.
Apparently this person... in question, Donald Sterling. Let me get my paperwork here. I'm not entirely sure about this, but apparently this was the person who did the recording was his girlfriend, and he's married.
Right.
Well, that's a vice. Adultery is a vice. Now, why didn't somebody say, you know, this is unthinkable that a man would cheat on his wife? We are not going to allow a person like that to have anything to do with the NBA. Incidentally, I think adultery is much more egregious than what he said. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
So it's kind of like you're picking and choosing your moral offenses here, and it becomes suspicious looking. Like, we are going to punish politically incorrect vice, but all the other vices, even if it's more damaging to people and to children and to families, we're not even going to bat an eye at. And my concern here was then if we are giving the nod to punishing a point of view, I mean, behaviors are something else. It's a different category. But here the guy he's got a bigoted soul. Let's just call it that. I mean, it seems to be the case. And he didn't deny that he'd made these remarks. So now what do we do about that? I think censure, censure, is entirely appropriate. Censuring is when you say that what somebody did was simply wrong. And I think that the House should come down on him in that regard. But there's a whole lot of other things that are going on now with regards to his case, where he is being forced to sell property that he owns, which is the Clippers. And there's a bunch of other decisions. And I don't know all the details and what the contractual arrangements are with the NBA and all that other stuff. And that those may be relevant from a legal perspective. That is, maybe the NBA is acting within its proper domain and is able to dispossess an owner from his team unilaterally. If the guy doesn't want to sell, I don't know who decides on what this, who's going to buy it then? Do they get the team at a discount? How does that work?
Right.
But when it seems all of these, so with legal questions aside, whether it's right to punish somebody for being a bigot, that's the question that I raise.
Because, right. To me, it kind of started making me think more about, from a Christian perspective, and in the way that you put tolerance in the classic sense, where you don't agree with something, but you put up with it, right? As Christians, where do we draw that legal boundary? Is that once it infringes upon certain, civil rights that we have, or is it the behaviors? Is that the thing where we as Christians say, look, we're not going to tolerate, we're going to rise up?
Right. Well, I'm not drawing legal lines here because I'm not an attorney. Legal rights are legal rights. But when it comes to what is right, I don't think that thought, bigotry, character qualities should be punished at all. Behaviors, yes, not character qualities. And once you do that, then you open the door wide open. I'll have more to say about this coming up. And I thank you for your call, Andy. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. Room in the lines if you'd like to call in here on our show, live on Tuesday nights. You're listening to Stand to Reason. Stay with us. Back at you here on Stand to Reason, Greg Kokel, your host, and the last caller has, of the last hour, reintroduced a topic that I opened with and the first hour of the show here, and that is the this whole debacle with Donald Sterling's racist remarks, Donald Sterling being the NBA Clippers owner, and how he's been ousted from the NBA and fined $2.5 million, and apparently there's an attempt to force a sale of the team. My comments in the first hour, just to summarize, was I think that this person, from what I could tell, is a cad, despicable and grotesque points of view and behaviors, not limited to racism, but other things as well, that didn't come up so much on the moral radar, because people weren't concerned with all the other things. They were concerned with this one, which I think it's a legitimate concern. So I'm not going to bat for him at all. However, it is a concern to me when thinking and character qualities become actionable legally in some sense. And I had mentioned earlier that why I don't think hate should be a crime. I actually wrote a piece that was it's on our website, Solid Ground, and this is a number of years ago. Why hate shouldn't be a crime. And because I don't think you should criminalize thought. And once you have criminalized thought, then you have to have thought police. And if the thought motivates an action which is criminal, then that action ought to be punished. If there's a hateful thought that motivates an assault, then you punish the assault. You don't add an additional punishment for what you imagine the person's thinking to be. I think it's a bad precedent, and this is my concern in what's been happening recently. I have in front of me a piece from townhall.com written by Michael Brown, who's a Christian apologist. This was posted on the 22nd of this month of April, and it says the New York City councilman puts bigotry on display, and it is a response to a remark made by, let's see, New York City Councilman Daniel Drom in a conversation with the Huffington Post regarding the plans that Chick-fil-A have to expand their business and set up restaurants in several locations in New York City. Now, some of you might remember the brouhaha that was created in about 4 years ago, or maybe 3 years ago, when Chick-fil-A planned on expanding into the city of Chicago, and a councilman there weighed in against them, and the mayor, I think, of the Chicago at the time weighed in against them, saying that if you don't share our values, you can't work in our city. Now, I thought that was an unusual thing to say, because since when does adhering, first of all, I don't even know who decides what the values of the city are. Did they take a poll, a vote? Dan Cathy, who was the owner of Chick-fil-A, he was his point of view, which, just so you know, the Chick-fil-A crowd is, or Dan Cathy is not in favor of same-sex marriage, but there has been nothing in his behavior with regards to Chick-fil-A employees or the restaurants or anything else that smacks of anything untoward. He just doesn't think that same-sex marriage is appropriate. But for this, he's been labeled a bigot, and then this comment came from the mayor of Chicago. You don't share our values. Well, those values that Dan Cathy had and still has are, as it turns out, were at the time the values of the President of the United States. They are no longer, but they were at the time. And they are the laws of the federal government and half the states in the union. So this was the thing that is so offensive. But what was going on there in Chicago is that Dan Cathy did not hold the views of that councilman and the elite in that city, and so therefore, you know, you can't do business in our city. Now, can you imagine a city in the South? I guess you can't even say this anymore like this, but let's just say the South, because they used to be more conservative, but not so much anymore, I don't know. But if they said, look, if you don't share our values, then you can't work in our city either. And our values are heterosexual, not homosexual. We don't support gay behavior. So if you're gay, you can't work in our city. Now, if somebody said that, they would burn that city down. That would be hyperbolically the reaction that they would have to that kind of comment. But why is it any better when it's spoken from the other side and the opposite side of the issue? From the left, not the right. Pro-homosexual, rather against homosexual. It isn't any better. It's the same thing, is the point that I'm making. And in the case of the New York City councilman, here's the way he put it. We don't need bigots coming to New York City. They are not welcome here. And this is a quote, by the way. New York City Councilman Daniel Dromm, D-R-O-M-M. This is in Michael Brown's article on townhall.com. We don't need bigots coming to New York City. They are not welcome here unless they can embrace all of New York's diverse community, including the LGBT community, close quote. Now, I just want you to see what is being said here. This is a councilman in the largest city of the country that's saying, unless you embrace these things, no, then you can't do business in our community, or at least he's rolling up the welcome mat. Whether they'll be forbidden from doing business is a different matter, but notice the sentiment that's being expressed here. You are not welcome. The irony is he's talking about New York's diverse community. Well, where is the diverse embracing of the diversity of Dan Cathy's view? The Chick-fil-A point of view, or at least the owner of Chick-fil-A. Well, it's not there, as you could tell. The Tolerance Street is a one-way street, as usual. Michael Brown makes the point here in this article, Chick-fil-A has never been found guilty of discrimination against an employer or customer based on sexual orientation. In that sense, in terms of providing quality service to all and being an equal opportunity employer, they have embraced everyone. Chick-fil-A is also famous for their customer care, often ranking first in takeout service rankings and commonly leading the way in terms of customer friendliness. Those taking your orders will often say that it's been their pleasure to serve you, while store managers have been known to go around to each table to see if drink refills or other items were needed, and they do so with a smile. And he adds, that would be something to behold in New York City, come to think of it. So in terms, once again, in terms of behaviors and actual practice and actions and the like, the Dan Cathy is a model citizen, but he doesn't hold the right views. He doesn't hold the right views, and this is why he's being told, don't come to our town. We don't want your kind here. Now, this is the concern that I have, friends. It's right back, and this is why I think that the NBA response to Clippers owners Donald Sterling's comments, you need to read between the lines here. We can be completely against the conduct, and I am. But I'm against a lot of his conduct from what I've heard of it, and other things that he said in the recording that nobody seems to be bothered by, the use of the F word, etc. But the racist things, that's offensive, I get it. But do we punish the point of view, the character, even the comments? Do we punish that? And does that lead, open the door then for punishment of further so-called bigotry, where this is bigotry, the other things that are called bigotry aren't. Homosexuality, opposing same-sex marriage. No, that's not bigotry. But that's what it's being called. So now Dan Cathy is not supposed to do business in New York City or Chicago or who knows where else. And by the way, when does that get shifted to churches? And don't say, no, that'll never happen here. You ought to know better by now. The dominoes are falling very, very quickly. And this means that very soon Christians are going to be paying a bigger price. Dan Cathy's paying a price right now for his convictions as a follower of Christ. In any event, I don't want to say any more about that. You can read the article. I encourage you to do so. Why Hate Shouldn't Be a Crime, because the substance is there. What's interesting about the hate crime stuff is it's only certain kinds of hate that are actionable. It's not just hate. It's certain types of politically incorrect hate, or at least the appearance of it, that are actionable. And ironically, it seems to me, when I step back and I witness some of the responses, that even though the things that were said recently by the Clippers owner are themselves despicable, the amount of actual bona fide hatred that is expressed, it seems, coming from the response to him. People hate him. I thought hate was wrong. Now, I understand the reaction, their emotions and everything, but if the problem is hate, why doesn't that concern apply on both sides of the equation? It simply does not. All right, let's see what I want to talk about here. I am bereft of callers at the moment, so let me I'm going to talk about a talk that I'm going to give in Poland coming up in about 3 weeks. I have canceled my trip to Wisconsin this year, by the way. Normally, that would be the next 2 weeks. The first 2 weeks or so of May, I go to Wisconsin to go fishing. And I catch the early fishing for smallmouth bass as they're moving into the shallows to spawn. It's called the pre-spawn season. Usually, the fish are big. They're accessible. They're in the shallows, and there's not many people on the water. Well, that is the case in spades right now, because even though opening day is Saturday, there is 24 inches of ice still sitting on the lakes in Wisconsin. And that's just too much for me to deal with right now. I don't want to go ice fishing. And so I've canceled and actually all week long, though there's supposed to be rain, most of the days it drops down to almost freezing anyway. So one wonders when the ice will finally dissipate. I'm going to be heading out mid-June instead. But towards the end of the month, I will be going to Poland. I'm going to be speaking for the European Leadership ELF. I think it's called European Leadership Fellowship. And this is a unique enterprise that's been going on for about 12 or 13 years. For most of that time in Eger, Hungary, and now moved to Poland. And I will be participating in this leadership conference that usually has about 600 people that are handpicked leaders from all over the European region, the Western European region, who are players in the Christian communities, pastors, universities, the like, but who are really, really under a tremendous amount of pressure from the culture, pushing back really hard. If you think we have it hard here in the States and getting harder, which we do, and it will be, they've got it a lot worse over there because Europe is so secularized. And so I get a chance to participate with a great number of other faculty doing workshops and sessions. And in my case, I'll be able to do a plenary session that's for everyone gathered together there. And I'm going to do that on naturalism. You know, naturalism, of course, is the point of view that nothing exists but nature and the material realm governed by natural laws. And I get an opportunity to try to share some ideas with the audience that will help them to manage the challenges of naturalism that they encounter in their culture. And we experience the same challenges here. And so I've put together a talk called Naturalism Bumping into Reality. Naturalism Bumping into Reality. Let me explain the concept here, because you might find this concept to be helpful for yourself. And that is that, and I developed this in the book on tactics in the chapter on taking the roof off. It's something that I learned from Dr. Francis Schaeffer. And the basic point is that Christians have reality on their side. Christians have reality on their side. We take Christianity to be true for a variety of reasons, and if true, then it reflects the way the world really is. And if it is the way the world really is, then those who disagree with Christianity are taking exception with reality. And they are denying the way the world actually is. And so at some point, they are going to have conflict between the way they say the world is and the way the world actually is. Now, Francis Schaeffer called these conflicts points of tension. There's a certain discontinuity between what they say and the way the world actually is. And if you listen carefully for them, you can hear when these points of conflict come up, and you can exploit them for good in conversations with them. And this is where taking the roof off as a tactic comes into play. The tactic, simply put, is that you take their point of view as true for the sake of discussion. And then you take it for a test drive and see where it leads. If it leads to someplace ridiculous or absurd, then that means there must be something wrong with where you started. And that's the point of the tactic. So I'm going to be trading on this notion for my entire talk at the ELF in the end of May in Katowice, Poland, talking about how the person who believes in naturalism as a worldview ends up getting assaulted by reality in three different areas. And I'm just going to, in summary, offer them to you here now, and then go to break and then take your calls. I call them the bump of stuff, the bump of bad, and the bump of me. Three things of reality that we bump into that seem to be inconsistent with naturalism. The bump of stuff. Where did we get stuff to begin with? Where did it all come from? That's the cosmological argument. A big bang needs a big bang, or naturalism cannot account for the origin of the universe. Something outside of nature has to account for that. The bump of bad is naturalism cannot account for evil in the world, and there is evil. Everybody complains about it. It's the most common objection that's raised to the existence of God. So there must be bad in the world, but naturalism cannot account for bad. Not objective bad, not the kind of bad that is necessary to ground the problem of evil. And finally, the bump of me, and that's the existential problem. That is, how do I deal with myself? How can I make sense of the individual I am, the mind-body person who goes through moral motions, who looks for meaning in the universe and yearns for it and hungers for it, and hungers for things like justice that was never had in this world perfectly, and who knows he's broken and in need of a solution to that brokenness, and that solution ultimately is in Christ. And so I'll be talking about that. So that's my 3-point outline: the bump of stuff, the bump of bad, the bump of me, to show that the Christian worldview can answer the challenges of reality, or answer the issues of reality, much better than naturalism as a worldview. Naturalism doesn't take these things seriously at all. It can't make sense of stuff. It can't make sense of bad. It can't make sense of me. That is the existential problem. All right. Ready to take your calls at 855-243-9975. I'm Greg Kokel. You're listening to Stand to Reason.
Stand to Reason with Greg Kokel is now a TV show. With an added level of interaction, see Greg in his element and follow discussions with on-screen questions. Tune in to NRB, National Religious Broadcasters, every Wednesday night at 11 p.m. Pacific Time, 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Available on DirecTV, Google Play, and Roku. And don't forget, you can always set your DVR to record the program so you can enjoy it whenever you'd like. You can find STR-TV on Wednesday nights at 11 p.m. Pacific Time, 2 a.m. Eastern Time on DirecTV, Google Play, and Roku. STR-TV, Christianity worth thinking about.
Would you like brief, easily digestible answers to some of the challenges you face as a Christian ambassador? Well, that's why we created our Ambassador's Guide series of booklets. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. With these booklets, you'll receive concise and approachable guides to various philosophies like pluralism and postmodernism, world religions such as Islam and Mormonism, even strategies on how to answer the challenges of the new atheists. To order a booklet from the Ambassador's Guide series, visit our online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON.
Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. That's the host. That's the show. Let's see. Joe in Buffalo. Let me get the button right. I don't want to lose you, Joe. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi, Greg. Good evening.
Good evening.
Hey, just want to first off just thank you for your show and your tactics book. I definitely learned a lot from it and enjoyed listening to it there.
Good, so, good.
And
good.
Looking forward to Jay Warner Wallace, who's going to be in our area this weekend.
Oh, fabulous.
Got my tickets and looking forward to that too.
Now that you mention it, we prayed for him at our staff meeting today and that things would go well. So you're in for a treat if you haven't seen Jay Warner Wallace yet.
No, this will be the first time, so looking forward to it.
Good for you.
Yeah, just a question for you. I just wondering, maybe get your thoughts on how to train up our kids, like our choices in Christian education.
Uh-huh.
I know you've mentioned in the past that your children attend a Christian school, and you're grateful for that.
Yes.
I know Brent Kunkel talked a couple weeks ago about playing the atheist in a Christian school and kind of rocking them a little bit with that. Maybe the apologetics and not having some clear answers.
Yes.
So just talk, your thoughts on, I sometimes talking to Christians, it seems like I get a feeling that it's a leading or people just get a different feeling what they should do. And I'm just wondering your thoughts on making that choice about how to train up your kids.
Oh, are you specifically asking about Christian schools versus public schools or something like that?
Yeah, Christian school versus homeschooling versus public schooling.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of the leading theology. That is, that you just kind of try to tune into God and see what God is nudging you to do, whether you send your kids to public school or to private Christian school or you homeschool or something like that. I think that whole approach to decision making is biblically misguided. Okay, so I'm not saying that one's feelings have no role in the process, and I'm not saying that God doesn't have any role. I think God does, but I don't think the way God makes his desires known is through what Christians have come to call leading. The notion of being led by the Spirit is in Romans chapter 8 and Galatians 5. That's the only two places it shows up. The Apostle Paul is the writer in both of those cases, and he means something very precise by the terminology, and he doesn't mean what virtually every Christian means when they use the same terminology and those verses as proof texts, that he isn't talking about being nudged towards decisions that God wants you to make. Something else entirely is going on there. I think what we're obliged to do is to go to the counsel of God's Word and using that as a guide, then decide with wisdom how to educate and raise up our children properly. Okay, now I know there are mixed feelings on this with regards to private school and public school and homeschooling, but I will tell you for myself, since we don't homeschool. I think some parents are not
situated for that, whether it's the somebody's temperament or their skills or their circumstances in life. They're just not well situated to do that task themselves. Then the question becomes, well, if you can't do that, well, then what about private school and what about public school? A lot of people can't even afford private school. Public school is their only option. In my case, we weren't going to homeschool, but we would make huge sacrifices in order to make sure that our children did not have to go to public school.
Yeah.
And I'm just telling you outright, and I'm not judging Christians who send their kids to public school, but they multiply their miseries and the difficulty of the task of raising their children in the fear and the discipline and the knowledge of the Lord considerably by sending their kids away for, 5 hours a day, 5 days a week or more, to an environment that is not neutral. There is no neutrality in education. They are not neutral. Now, that doesn't mean that they're beasts, but it means their point of view is not neutral. And so now when the educational system, which is not neutral, but rather given to secular ideology and secular impulses and secular values, is the one that is spending more time with your children than you are, boy, that's trouble brewing. And it's not just what is taught, but is what is absorbed by the social groups around, by the larger milieu, you know, the school and the posters and the rationale and the way things are expressed and what is held to be valuable. It is not the things of the Lord. Nothing about the Lord is held valuable in that public environment. Quite to the contrary. So other things are held to be valuable, like self-esteem, which you're never going to find that kind of thing in the Bible. You know, not that people should hate themselves. I don't want my girls to have a bad. I want my girls to have an accurate self-image, not a good self-image. I don't want them to feel good about being bad.
Sure. Yeah. Knowing that they're made in the image of God and knowing that they're...
Yeah, that's right. We're made out of good stuff, but we're badly broken. We're beautiful, but we're broken, and they need to know both of those things. So they're not going to get that at school either. You know, they're going to get a different view of reality from a public school, whether it is explicitly taught or implicitly absorbed. And plus, they're going to get a whole bunch of kids who believe that stuff, who are talking it all the time. So the cultural group that they find themselves immersed in, it's not just the teaching in the school, but it's all the people around them. And I know, we're supposed to be in the world but not of it, but if you want to teach a kid to swim, you don't take him out into the deep end of the pier and toss him in when he's six. He's going to go to the bottom. And so you're protecting your kids. You're darn right I'm protecting my kids. I'm going to protect my kids as long as I possibly can and in the process be equipping them for when they have to go on the deep end, they're going to be capable of surviving it. And to me, that's responsible parenting. Now, if it turns out that we could not do what we're doing, then we would have to really, really amp up our attention to the details. And it seems to me we're already doing that pretty good.
Yeah, it sounds like you've got a good plan going with spending time in the Proverbs with your daughter.
Please don't anyone get the impression I do that every night with my daughter. It's less than more. But I try to do it. I'm trying to when I can, and then the opportunities, then I'll do that. I'm not sitting down every night, but I'm trying to invest. So the point I'm making is, even under the best of circumstances, I'm realizing that the investment that we are able to make as parents is still probably falling short. How much more problematic that would be if our children were spending all that time in a public school.
Okay? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like you said, I really look at it. It was a blessing that we were able to train up our kids. And it was amazing, the Christian curriculum, and seeing everything all interwoven with the courses and government. Even the government book, just that government was founded by God. And
that's right.
Seeing it interwoven through it was a real blessing.
So. Right, right. Well, you can instill those foundational things in your kids. You said you were homeschooled? You homeschool
your kids? Yeah, we homeschooled while they were in high school. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I consistently remind myself how thankful that I am that mm-hmm. my daughters are go to a place where the teachers and local parentis, that in other words, they're in the place of the parents, are actually ideologically in local parentis. That is, that they are cooperating with our value system. They are not fighting against our value system. In the public school system, you have two sets of parents. You have the real parents, and then you have the teachers in the place of parents. That's in local parentis. And you have two different value systems that are being communicated. Not everything is opposite, but the starting points are completely different. And so the children get two different messages, and mm-hmm. it becomes very, very difficult. It can be done, but it just adds to the difficulty when the messages compete the way they mm-hmm. do. And I'm just glad that we don't have to do that. Our school is not just a Christian school. That is, they believe in Christ and they have Christian values. But our school is it teaches a thoroughgoing Christian worldview, top mm-hmm. to bottom. And so and it's a trivium classical school, so that's even better. For example, and you'll get a kick out of this, when my 9-year-old and my 6-year-old had a tiff last week, my 9-year-old answered her with a rejoinder in Latin. So she, the 6-year-old got the sense of it, but she didn't, you know, anyway, if your kids got to fight with each other, if they can fight in a dead language like that, that's all right with me.
Yeah, something's going good there. Oh,
yeah,
good. Yeah.
Yeah.
So. I was just wanted to wake you up, and it seems to me that's where I try to encourage parents to, you know, open up your Bibles, look at these passages, you know, and weigh them and make your decision. You know.
Yes. Yeah. And again, if we did not have access to this school or something like it, it would be a lot harder for me to do all the things that are necessary to raise up our children in the way they should go. And, mm-hmm. and I suspect even homeschooling parents are, you know, are wondering, gee, am I doing enough? So it's a hard task, and the culture is not cooperating. We watch almost no TV, and that makes our job a whole lot easier.
Mm-hmm.
Parents that also have TV on, public school, you come back from school, then what do? Watch a few hours of TV, and now you got the images that are blaring these same messages. And plus that's sucking your time away from your kids too. So having meals together, that's huge. Being able to everybody sit down together at a dinner table and have a meal, that's huge. And a lot of parents don't do that because kids are coming and going and parents are coming and going and people are eating by themselves in front of the TV set. And so somebody else is doing the training.
Yeah. Sometimes it's a lot of the activities, it seems too. I mean, it's not just the public schools. It's also the couple different activities.
Soccer.
And
And my girls do gymnastics, but, you know, I don't care about the competitive aspect of it. I just want them moving for an extra hour for 4 days a week. And so they get dropped off from the school carpool at the gymnastics, and we pick them up at the end. We take out in the morning, and then we pick them up from gymnastics in the evening, so it's part of their schedule 4 days mm-hmm. a week. They get some more exercise. But we're not giving up our weekends to soccer tournaments all over the state and stuff like that. Forget about that. We just don't want that for our kids.
All right. Well, hey, thank you very much. I was just, I've done a lot of reading on your site and just looking around and just wanted to kind of get your thoughts on it there. So,
all right, Joe. Joe from Buffalo, it's good to talk to you. I appreciate the call. Let's go quickly to break, and then we got more calls we're going to jump on board with right after we get back.
You can find STR on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and Pinterest. Interact with STR staff, post comments, get involved with other like-minded Christians. Want to know what is going on with STR? Speaking events, new podcasts, resources, and articles, follow STR online. You can find all of our social media connections at str.org.
Don't forget, Stand to Reason's live broadcast is Tuesdays, 4 to 7 p.m. on the web. That's Pacific time, by the way. So go to STR.org to listen live or use your STR app to stream it live. You can also give me a piece of your mind by calling at that time, Tuesdays, 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific time. Here's the number, 855-243-9975. And, of course, you can listen on the radio, like always, on Sundays, 2 to 5 p.m. Pacific time. But for the live broadcast, tune in online Tuesdays, 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific time by going to str.org. All right, final segment here. A bunch of good callers piled on here. So let's go right to them. Tom, in wherever you're at. Tom, welcome to the show. Hi.
Hey, Craig. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had kind of a odd question. I was wondering, did Judas think he was a follower, or do you think he was always kind of faking it?
No, I think my opinion is that Judas thought he was a follower. But we have to keep in mind the mindset of the disciples back then. Because when we think from here, looking back, we think, was he a believer? Was he a Christian? Was he? Well, they didn't think of it that way. They thought Jesus was the Messiah.
Okay.
All right. And but they had, all of them had a kind of twisted understanding of what that entailed. The other 11, they were in it for the long haul, and they were going to take Jesus, as hard as it was for them sometimes, as he came to them. And if you think about in John 6, the Bread of Life discourse, this is about halfway through his ministry. It's the end of his period of public approval. And he gives this discourse when they want to make him king. And he had just fed the 5,000. He said, hey, don't yearn for the bread that perishes, but rather for the bread of life, me. And as a result of that conversation, the largest portion of his following simply abandoned him. And he turned to the disciples. This is at the end of John 6. And he said, aren't you also going to go? And Peter said, where are we going to go? You have the words that give eternal life.
Yeah.
And I think the point there was is he didn't like what Jesus had said any better than anybody else. But, you know, you got to take the good with the bad. I don't understand that. And, boy, that's pretty offensive. And but you're the guy. So we're sticking with you. Now, I think that was Judas's genuine sentiment and the other 10, but I don't think that was Judas's. I think Judas's sentiment, that was Peter's, but not Judas's. Judas's sentiment was that this guy is the Messiah, and he had a very materialistic understanding of the way the kingdom was going to come about. And my opinion is, though we've got very little to go on here, but I think that he was trying to force Jesus' hand.
Okay.
And the movie Jesus of Nazareth, I think, plays this out quite well. That 40-year-old or 30-year-old film is still one of the best, probably the best, of the life of Jesus, because so much of it I think they get right. And Judas is this political revolutionary who sees Jesus as the guy who's going to be Messiah and bring Israel against the Romans, and he tries to force Jesus' hand. And then he realizes at the end that he made a mistake. He betrayed innocent blood, and then he hangs himself out of remorse, not out of repentance.
Okay.
Keep in mind too, Judas was also a thief. He used to pilfer from the change box or whatever, the piggy bank.
Yeah.
And so he was a disreputable character. He was not a genuine believer in Jesus, fully committed. Whatever, he had his own agenda,
and he followed. Has an ulterior motive.
Yes, he followed out of his own convenience, and so he was willing to betray Jesus for political expediency. I don't think that Judas thought Jesus was going to be executed. I think Judas thought Jesus was going to call down the angels from heaven and bring in the kingdom when his hand was forced. He didn't get it.
Okay.
So I have no reason to believe that Judas was genuinely a believer in the sense that the other disciples were.
Well, Greg, thanks. I really appreciate it.
All right, Tom. You're welcome. I'm glad you called, and glad we got you in here. Let's go to Brownsburg, Indiana, and Steve. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Greg. How you doing, sir?
Good. Glad you called.
Hey, thank you. Yeah, I've got a question. It's been on my mind for a while. I've heard it come up a couple times, and I just want to make sure I got my facts straight because I don't want to create a straw man or anything like
that. Sure.
And I know Sam Harrison wrote a book on free will, but...
Sam Harris, right, the new atheist.
Yeah, Sam Harris, yeah, sorry. So my question is, if the atheist is being intellectually honest, are they forced to deny free will or say it's an illusion or something to that effect? And if so, why is that exactly the case?
Yeah, I think that they would be forced by the logic of their worldview to affirm determinism. Now, I'm chuckling here a little bit because there's a catch-22 in this for them. Because if determinism is true, then they're only affirming determinism because they've been determined to do so, not because there are intellectual merits to determinism as a view. You would not, if determinism were true, you would not be able to weigh the merits of any point of view.
Okay.
But I don't see how their view escapes the charge for this reason. Atheists... almost universally, now there can be some exceptions to this, but almost universally, that is, virtually every atheist that you'll run into is going to be a materialist.
Right.
That is, they believe, and this is the case for all of the new atheists and those like them, that is, they believe that there is the only thing that exists is the physical world governed by natural laws. So material stuff is real. That's it. Immaterial stuff is not real.
Right.
It's all physical, governed by natural laws. And that's why this view is called either variously materialism, physicalism, or naturalism. Okay? All right. Let's just say that that's the case. Now, what does such a world look like? Well, in that kind of world, there are only... molecules in motion. And what governs the motion of the molecules? Well, natural laws. Therefore, any particular event that takes place is the result of some prior event that caused it. So dominoes, just think of dominoes falling.
Okay. I was thinking pinball machines.
The problem with pinball machines is you've got somebody that's pulling the spring bob firing the pinball out.
Okay.
So you have an agent that's making a decision.
Okay.
Okay. But purely physical things are not agents. They are just objects.
Right.
And if objects respond when another object hits it, it doesn't choose to respond. It responds by virtue of physical necessity. Have one domino fall against the other. The force of the first domino causes the second domino to fall. The second domino doesn't choose. It is an event causation. Its falling is caused by a prior event, and it is an event that causes another event, the domino after it, to fall. So just think of falling dominoes. No choices there. Now, if the universe is completely, if you can exhaust your description of reality by physical descriptions of physical things operating by natural law, there is no place in that world for acts of freedom.
Okay.
Because acts of freedom are done by an agent, and an agent is a conscious entity that is capable of initiating a causal chain.
If that's true, would it literally, Sam Harris had no choice to write his book on free will?
That's right. Yes, and I mean literally. If he is physically determined, he is not choosing anything.
Okay.
And in fact, I have an article here, or a portion of it, about 3 years ago, Stephen Hawking and... His co-author Mladenov, I can't remember his first name, I'm looking for it, wrote a book called The Grand Design. And the grand design is an explanation of everything, basically. And their point in their book, The Grand Design, is that there is no grand design, that physics is everything, and we are all determined.
Right.
That's one of their points, at least. And so I actually have a portion of this in front of me, and I take time to explain how, if physics is everything, one has to ask the question, what did the laws of physics determine the order of the words on the pages of the book, The Grand Design?
Right.
Because if physics is everything, then that would have to be the case. But I suspect that Professors Hawking and Mladenov pondered the evidence for their theories, considered the implications of the facts. They posited their conclusions, then chose the right words, and selected the precise order that would best communicate their views and persuade readers of the rationality of their point. Notice all of those words I emphasized all require a choice.
Right.
But if physics is everything, there is no choice. So there's a massive contradiction here.
Yeah, it seems pretty glaring, and it seems in my experience that not many atheists are aware of that shortcoming of their view.
And this is a fair thing to ask of an atheist. If atheism is true, and this is where you may need to ask an information question at the front end of your conversation, what kind of atheist are you? Are you a materialistic atheist?
That is, so what are the choices there? Materialistic and what else?
Well, you could be a dualist atheist. That is, you could believe in the material world and the immaterial world, or you could be a monist. That is, you believe only in the immaterial world and not in the physical world. That the physical world is an illusion. You could be a Platonistic atheist or something like that. But those are the options. Most atheists are materialists. Atheism is, and there's confusion on this, unfortunately, means a belief that there is no God. It's the rejection of the idea that God exists. It's affirming the proposition God does not exist. Okay. So you could affirm that in three different views of reality, but generally it is not a dualist view, and it isn't a view that only immaterial things exist. It's rather a materialist point of view. But you could clarify that, and it will show that you know a little bit about atheism, maybe even more than the atheist knows, that there's different varieties.
So all the new atheists are materialists.
Yes.
Correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
As far as I can tell.
And then most of the popular culture reads their books. So it's
I think it's safe to assume that. But then once that is, then you get clear on that, then fine. Then you could say, okay, so nothing but physical things exist. Okay, causes are what? They're event causations. They're molecules banging against each other, right? Okay, now how do you account for free will?
Right.
In that scenario.
So they have no choice but to talk to me, right?
Yeah, something like that. I think they're stuck. And this is why people like Sam Harris are going to have to bite the bullet and say, I'm a determinist.
Okay.
Because I don't see any other option that you have.
Okay. No, thank you. That's fair enough. It just seems so glaring.
Yes, I think so. And if a determinist, by the way, if there is no free will, I don't know where you get morality. But he has a book that I just bought a couple weeks ago because I'm writing an article that is answering some things in that book. And his book is on morality from an atheistic perspective, even though you're a determinist. How can you have determinism and morality? Because doesn't right and wrong entail some sense of freedom in order to be held responsible?
Yeah, no, the contradictions are pretty thick.
I think you're right. I think they are.
Okay.
All right, Steve.
Greg, I appreciate your time.
Yeah, you're welcome. I appreciate your call. Let's talk with Al in Dallas. And you made it, Al.
Oh, great. Thanks, Greg, for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to just briefly thank you. Last week, you know, you gave a kind of a brief little talk about the difference between knowing Christianity is true and believing. And it was kind of an indictment on me. And I just want to thank you. It kind of caused me to reflect on my own faith and my own Christian life, and I do appreciate that.
Good. Well, good. I'm glad I stirred you up a little bit.
Sure. I'll get right into my question. I've been speaking with a relative of my wife's, actually, and she's a Christadelphian. I don't know much about the sect at all. So over dinner, I was just kind of probing and trying to seek out exactly, you know, what she believes and why she believes it.
Uh-huh. Good
and,
for you.
We came to the point to where she kind of told me that she doesn't believe that Jesus is an infinite being, is eternal, that he was mm-hmm. created and then somehow became God through the power of God. Now, what I would like to do, because our conversation was brief, I'd like to kind of hover around that idea with you and
yeah.
maybe come up with, you know, what are the implications of that, of Christ being
right.
finite, you know?
Sure. Well, one implication is he can't be made God, because the kind of God we're talking about, unless you really radically recharacterize this word and make it kind of like a God-like, it's some kind of exalted being, but not God, because God himself is perfect and
right.
In all of his attributes. And so he will be without beginning and without end. He is the ground of being himself. That's called aseity, that he's self-existence. And so Jesus can't become God. At some later time, he doesn't graduate to godhood, because you don't graduate to the infinite.
Would you say that even if Jesus couldn't come to the level of God, that he's still worth worshiping? Would his sacrifice still be worth anything?
Well, there's a couple things there in your question, and I'm just jumping into it because I'm looking at the clock going, so I'm not going to draw you out slowly. If he is not God himself, then he is not worth worshiping. In fact, if you worship a created thing, that's idolatry. So, and of course, I'm imposing now, bringing into play biblical Christian values here.
Sure.
Worship is reserved for God himself, the one God who is perfect in all aspects and therefore worthy of being worshipped. Jesus, if he's a created being, he's a thing. If he's merely a created being, then he is a thing, and worshiping a thing is idolatry.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jesus would not be worth worshiping. And then it does draw into question the nature of his sacrifice, because how could some finite being die for multiple finite beings and have that death be efficacious, be effective to accomplish an end? And the medievals argued about this. Anselm, for example, why the God-man? Well, because God had to become a man to accomplish the things that Jesus accomplished on the cross. He could not have secured the redemption that was necessary for us unless his sacrifice had an eternal dimension to it. A mere man could not have done what Jesus did. And it had to be the God-man. It had to be a man dying for man, but it had to be God who added humanity to himself that was adequate to accomplish the kind of sacrifice that would be necessary to secure forgiveness for humanity.
Now I was planning on maybe presenting before her the idea of Jesus' sacrifice as a payment of a debt, and the idea that how can only an infinite sacrifice can atone for, you know, the numerous amount of sin that it has to atone for forever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would you say that that was a sufficient way to present it to her?
Well, I think that's in principle, that's a great way to argue, and this is the way Anselm argued, and possibly Augustine. Maybe I'm getting my ancients mixed up here, but in any event, the real question here is what will appeal to her.
Yeah,
and I think in her mind, it might appear that it's her theology against your theology, and who's to say?
Sure,
well, that's
sure.
your theological view, but this is my theological view. So I was thinking of an approach that was a little bit antecedent to that step, and that is, where are you getting your information about Jesus?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's only one place, one kind of source to get any detail about Jesus of Nazareth. And that's from the primary source historical documents, those documents which have demonstrated themselves to be the accurate source of information about Jesus of Nazareth, and that would be those documents that we know as Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
Yeah.
So when you identify your source, then you can go back to source material to see, well, how did Jesus view himself? And if what she's drawing on is other kinds of revelation, maybe second or third century Gnostic type gospels, or maybe the ideas of her Christadelphian leaders.
Yeah,
But why should we take their word for it, essentially, instead of taking the most primitive documentation of Jesus' life as our source material?
Yeah, I think she may actually be more receptive to that approach. That's good. I wrote that down. I'm going to use that.
Yeah, how do you know? Where are you getting your information about Jesus?
Yeah.
How about if we go back to the most ancient sources of Jesus and then see what they said? These are the people who walked with Jesus and lived with him, and see what they recorded. And then another thing that's important, especially on the issue of deity of Christ, is to see how the people in the context of their culture responded to the things that Jesus said. Mm-hmm. So when sometimes people will say, well, Jesus didn't claim to be God, he claimed to be the Son of God.
Right.
Yes, but that's true. But what you don't understand is that claiming to be the Son of God is a claim to divinity, to be the God, and the Jews of the time understood that. You know, why are you picking up stones to stone me? Because you, being a man, make yourself equal with God. Or Jesus said he could forgive sins in Mark 2. Who can forgive sins but God alone? You know, so, you know, those are the, you have to look at those texts themselves to be able to help her to see that this is what Jesus had in mind. It wasn't just a make-me-up God. He was talking about himself being the real God. And here's another line of argument that you can offer from the text, and it's in the Gospel of John. The story of the Bible starts, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. John starts his account of Jesus' life almost exactly the same way. In the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Verse 2, all things came into being through him, and apart from him, nothing came into being that has come into being. In other words, the Word who became Jesus was the uncreated creator, the same creator who started the whole thing going in Genesis 1:1. I don't know. You can start there with her and see what happens. Al, thanks for the call, and give me a call back some other time and let me know how it went, all right? That's all the time we have for our show, friends. Thank you for spending this time with me. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven this week. Bye-bye now.
Listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.